Good afternoon. I'm going to call the meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order. I'm going to note a quorum. We are going to be missing two members. The two public members, ironically, will not be here with us today. And one, it was Michael Brown and Geraldine Natz. I'll talk about Geraldine in a minute. So we have a very active and packed agenda with major things today. And one of the things that surprised me about the morning report is they listed everything we had on the agenda except sea level rise, which I thought was the biggest item on the agenda. And so that is going to be a key part of today's meeting. The thing I wanted to do is acknowledge that the Lieutenant Governor, as chair of the State Lands Commission, has rotated back onto the council for a year. We're very glad to have him. He's very interested in ocean issues. And we are hoping that Senator Hertzberg, when a hearing ends, will come and Bill Craven is sitting in for him until that happens. This would be his first meeting replacing the state Senate seat that had been held for a long time by Senator Fran Pavley, who was term limited out since we met last. And Bill managed to survive the change and is still the alternate for that. And so I'm happy that he is here. Assemblymember Quirk just this morning let us know that he is going to have a hearing that's going to keep him out. And what I wanted to do, too, in the brief comments at the beginning, is we were hoping Geraldine Natz would be here because this would be her last meeting. We do have term limits on the Ocean Protection Council, and she has been a member for 10 years, since 2007, virtually the entire history of the council. And we wanted to recognize her, and I have a letter and other things that will be sent to her separately, but I just want to acknowledge that she's been on the council for virtually its entire history as a public member. She brought a unique perspective because she was first the manager of the Port of Long Beach and then the general manager of the Port of Los Angeles. And so it brought her experience both dealing with business in a major way, as a port operator from that part of the state. That experience was really valuable, especially her commitment to oceans within that experience, and we will miss it. And she was always diligent, well-prepared, asked good questions, rarely missed a meeting, which is ironic that she is missing her last. And so I just wanted, on behalf of the council, to acknowledge that she was a great servant, and we will miss her. And I have taken the opportunity to express personally to her exactly what we felt about her good service. Then to update on a couple of things, on December 13th, the governor and myself, with statements from the governor of Oregon, the governor of Washington, and councilor representatives from France and Chile, there were people there from Quebec, in San Diego, in conjunction with the Western Governors Conference, we launched the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification. And the idea is that we can't do it alone. Even though we have made grants, conducted studies, united with the West Coast governors, this is a worldwide problem. And so it is another way. Just Matt Rodriguez is probably very excited that there's a subnational agreement that he is not doing himself. But it was great first participation, and I think that we are really looking forward to that. And in conjunction with that, on June 5th to 9th in New York, the governments of Fiji and Sweden will host the United Nations Oceans Conference, talking about the Sustainable Development Goal. And I hope to be able to attend. along with some OPC staffers and other people involved with the Alliance, and we want to showcase voluntary commitments that have been made on this issue and the different governments internationally that are coming together to deal with it. And we aim to have 60-plus members of the Alliance by the conference and a pathway for a subset of action plans from the governments announcing their acidification strategies by a year from now. So we are moving ahead on that. The Oceans Conference will do it, and we made that announcement. And also, last week, the State Lands Commission announced that Venoco had quitclaimed its interest in the oil leases off the coast of Goleta and Santa Barbara County, including Platform Holly and the Goleta Beach Pier. This effectively ends commercial oil and gas production in state waters in this location, returns operational control of the assets to the State Lands Commission. I know we have the executive director of the Lands Commission here who may address that later in the meeting. And then I should just say, we're going to talk about it endlessly and hear a report, but we will deal with ocean acidification, sea level rise as part of the agenda. And the significant thing is not just the science that we will hear. It will be the process to turn it to the guidance for local governments and other people and take the science and put it into action. So with that, I'm going to ask in a moment if other council members have announcements, but I want to remind everybody that this meeting is being live webcasted, and making a gesture or nod is not necessarily picked up at home. Be verbal if you can bring yourselves to do it. It's very important to turn off cell phones that interfere with the AV equipment. We'll take public comment after item 4, 5, and 7. And then there's, and at the back of the room, there'll be speaker cards. You can fill one out for each agenda item and wish to speak and place them in the basket here at the front of the room. Public comments are limited to 3 minutes. And there's a light on the podium that's supposed to turn, but I don't see the light. I just assume the light is somewhere. And hopefully by the time somebody gets to 3 minutes, that light will materialize. Pardon? That's it. Well, I for the lieutenant governor who's rotating back on, somebody went over the 3 minutes once, and I said that if she went another 5 seconds, the trap door would open, and she looked like she believed it and stepped away from the microphone. So I think that's what the reference was to. So this would be the opportunity for any of their council members, if they have any opening comments they'd like to make. Seeing none, then we'll move on to item 2, which is the report from the executive director.
Good afternoon. My name is Jen Eckerly. I am your new Ocean Protection Council deputy director, and I was in that role for about 2 weeks before I became your interim executive director while Deborah Halberstadt is out on maternity leave. These past 4.5 months have been very exciting. I'd like to give a big thanks to the entire staff at OPC and the Natural Resources Agency. I've been blown away with their professionalism, their dedication, and their tireless work ethic, and I'm very proud and grateful to be a part of this group. I'd like to especially acknowledge Joanna Stone from OPC, who does so much work behind the scenes and whom without we would not function. I would also like to extend my gratitude to Secretary Laird for his continued support and incredible leadership. Yesterday, Senator Hertzberg, during the Oroville hearing, said that Secretary Laird was a rock star, and I could not agree more.
Well, we could have gone the whole meeting without that being said.
you would have run it.
Oh, no. Yeah. He's humming Don't Stop Believing over here.
Deborah will be back with the OPC on June 5th, and we're all looking forward to having her. And I would also like to welcome our new members, Lieutenant Governor Newsom and Senator Hertzberg, who will hopefully join us shortly. We're looking forward to your perspective and insights to help advance our work. And I would also like to say thank you to Geraldine Natz, who is an integral part of this council. So next, I'd like to give an update on the status of our Proposition 1 and Proposition 84 grant programs. For Proposition 1 in June 2016, the council approved approximately $7.4 million in Proposition 1 funds for 8 projects to improve water quality through pollution source reduction and habitat restoration and enhancement. Staff has finalized 6 grant agreements, with the remaining 2 agreements close to being finalized with the grantees. We had originally planned to solicit projects for round 2 of Proposition 1 funding in May 2017. However, staffing capacities have resulted in a revised timeline, and we now anticipate bringing Proposition 1 grant guidelines to this council in fall of 2017, with project solicitation for round 2 anticipated in 2018. The available funding for the second round of Proposition 1 funding is expected to be $11.2 million, with an additional allocation of $9.3 million anticipated for the 2019-2020 fiscal year. At your October meeting, this council approved approximately $6 million in Proposition 84 funds for 16 projects supporting OPC's priority areas of climate change, marine protected areas, marine pollution, and sustainable fisheries. Staff has finalized 10 of those grant agreements, with the remaining 6 close to being finalized. There's approximately $16 million remaining in Proposition 84 funds, $5.5 million of which this council has already set aside for fisheries and marine protected area projects. We are considering establishing a targeted competitive process for the remaining $10.5 million and anticipate bringing another round of projects to the council throughout 2018. I'd like to give a brief update on our staffing. In December, Amy Vieira left the OPC, and we wish her best in her new endeavors. With Amy's departure, OPC has posted a job announcement for an environmental scientist to continue administering our Proposition 1 grant program. Staff anticipates filling this position next month, and the job announcement can be found on our website. In January, we welcomed Paige Barabee to our staff as the new Fisheries Program Manager. Paige worked with the Sustainable Fisheries Group at UC Santa Barbara, and her master's thesis group project was focused on the commercial swordfish fishery in California. Paige was previously a Sea Grant Fellow at OPC, working in our climate program, and she has been instrumental in helping us shepherd our sea level rise work forward over the last year and a half. And in February and March, we welcomed 2 new Sea Grant Fellows, Sarah Briley and Tova Handelman. Sarah comes to us from the Orange County Coastkeeper, where she led the native oyster and eelgrass restoration efforts as their marine restoration director. Sarah's supporting our work in our climate program on sea level rise and ocean acidification. And Tova comes to OPC from Heal the Bay, where she was the Coastal Resources Director, working on the California Plastic Bag Ban campaign and citizen science programs such as MPA Watch. Tova is supporting our Marine Protected Areas program. I'd like to give a brief update on some of our program highlights. The Executive Director Report provides a detailed summary of our work since the December meeting, focused on marine pollution, climate change, marine protected areas, and emerging issues. I'll provide a few highlights now. Just to build on what the Secretary mentioned about the UN Ocean Conference, in addition to the efforts focused around the Ocean Acidification Alliance, the OPC is working closely with state agency partners to pull together a comprehensive package of voluntary commitments that highlight the work that California is doing, not only around ocean acidification, but also around climate adaptation, marine protected areas, marine pollution, and sustainable fisheries. We have been working on multiple fronts in our climate program. I'm going to start briefly with our work on ocean acidification, but you will hear more about that later during item 8. In October, Jen Phillips, OPC's climate policy advisor, co-hosted a workshop with Stanford University and the Southern California Coastal Water Resources Research Project in response to one of the recommendations from the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel focused on developing water quality criteria to address the impacts from ocean acidification and hypoxia. The workshop outlined the process by which state managers and scientists can work together to define monitoring needs and interpret monitoring and modeling results, and this information can provide a framework for establishing revised water quality criteria in the future. OPC has also been heavily involved in the state's climate adaptation efforts. We are the lead in the ocean and coastal resources section of the California's adaptation plan, Safeguarding California, and are serving as the technical manager for California's fourth climate change assessment research projects related to ocean acidification, ocean temperature, and hypoxia. Additionally, with the support of the Ocean Protection Council's science advisory team, OPC is leading a regional assessment focused on oceans and coasts that will be paired with other regional assessments. You will hear more about this in items 6 and 7, but Ocean Protection Council, along with the Natural Resources Agency, in collaboration with state partners and the Ocean Science Trust, have been working to help California prepare for the impacts of sea level rise. Decisions we make today will have impacts on people, special places, and infrastructure, and we are committed to creating a policy guidance that is grounded in the best available science, understandable and responsive to user needs, and accounts for potentially significant impacts of sea level rise on coastal and inland communities. And I'd just like to thank the scientists who participated in our working group and Ocean Science Trust, particularly Liz Whiteman, for her great work on this project. With our sustainable fisheries program, Ocean Protection Council has been working closely with Ocean Science Trust on a variety of projects to inform the Department of Fish and Wildlife's update of the Marine Life Management Act Master Plan for Fisheries. These projects include climate change in fisheries, which Tom will talk more about in his presentation, a peer review project to provide guidance and recommendations on the best practices to support a rigorous peer review process for fisheries, and an ecological risk assessment tool to help assess the risk of a fishery on bycatch and target species and habitats. As you recall, in 2015-16, we had a series of harmful algal bloom events. OPC established an interagency task force made up of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Public Health, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and the Fish and Game Commission. This task force worked closely to respond to these events in a timely and transparent manner, using scientific information to inform decisions about whether to open or close a fishery. Additionally, a working group of our science advisory team was created to address these harmful algal blooms and their impact on California fisheries. I think maybe Tom will also speak to that briefly in his presentation. And I would just note that the second phase of that working group is going to focus on an analysis and synthesis of long-term impacts on domoic acid in the marine environment. This document will provide state managers information about needed investments to better predict and plan for future harmful algal bloom events. In our Marine Protected Areas program, we're going to get an update specifically on the efforts that have been happening around the Marine Protected Area collaboratives, but I wanted to give you a brief update on the Once Through Cooling Interim Mitigation Program. So as you know, in 2010, the State Water Resources Control Board adopted a policy requiring coastal power plants
just for the members. Yes. At our last meeting, I asked that this be done because we entered into the agreement to take the Once Through Cooling mitigation funds and move them for marine programs and some wet ones. And all that happened is that the members knew the agreement had been made. They didn't know what was in it. And so that's the nature of this report.
Yes, thank you, Secretary. So, the details of that memorandum of understanding include the designation of $5.4 million annually to the Ocean Protection Council to support MPA management. I just wanted to let you know that the Water Board staff have determined that 8 of the 10 power plants subject to this once through cooling policy will have their mitigation fee calculations based on a default method for entrainment. The remaining 2 power plants, which include Diablo Canyon and Encina Power Plant, have submitted site-specific data and request that mitigation payments be calculated on a specific habitat production foregone method for cost of entrainment. Draft determinations for the mitigation fees for all 10 power plants will likely be released for public review at the end of May, and OPC staff expects to begin receiving mitigation funds by this fall. In order to be thoughtful about how that funding is spent, OPC is working with the MPA statewide leadership team to develop guideline criteria for how we are going to identify projects appropriate to receive this funding. Those projects will likely focus on outreach to improve compliance, improved enforcement, and monitoring to determine MPA effects related to once-through cooling impacts. This criteria is expected to be released at the end of 2017 and will include a public process to solicit public input. And on our marine pollution program on April 18th and 19th, the staff, OPC staff hosted a workshop to develop a conceptual model for trash monitoring methods. The workshop included staff from the State Water Resource Control Board, the Regional Water Board, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, the San Francisco Estuary Institute, and other constituents that have performed trash monitoring research. The workshop enabled participants to discuss current challenges in trash monitoring and provide advice for future trash monitoring projects to consider during design and scoping. This workshop was intended to provide a starting point for the proposed monitoring methods project that you will hear during item 5. Our first stakeholder workshop for updating California's litter strategy is scheduled for May 2nd and 3rd. This workshop will give state and federal agencies, conservation organizations, and industry an opportunity to develop projects that will address the ocean litter problem. A second workshop to allow participants to commit to proposed projects is anticipated for the fall. And finally, on our emerging issues program, as I think many of you know, in October of last year, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and the State of California convened an Intergovernmental Renewable Energy Task Force, which is a partnership of federal, state, local agencies, and tribal governments as a forum to provide critical information to the decision-making process for the future of offshore renewable energy in California. The Ocean Protection Council has been participating in the task force efforts by assisting with stakeholder engagement, including outreach to fishermen, local elected officials, scientists, and environmental groups. We're also helping to identify relevant science and data sets to ensure that marine resources and human uses are integrated into the planning efforts. The next meeting of that task force is scheduled for July 13th, tentatively in Santa Barbara, after which the Ocean Protection Council staff will reinitiate the work of our California Marine Renewable Energy Working Group to update the permit guidance that we published in 2011. That update will include expanded guidance for offshore wind, include guidance for commercial scale projects, and potentially include guidance for developing marine mitigation framework for impacts to fisheries and marine life. Finally, I just wanted to say a few words about the federal budget. Since our last council meeting in December, the Trump administration has released a high-level plan for federal spending in 2018. While this skinny budget is still very much a draft, it includes proposed funding cuts that would significantly impact federal programs and grants focused on addressing climate change and coastal and ocean protection, including efforts that support ongoing research, resource management, and monitoring and education. Ocean Protection Council staff is tracking the federal budget process closely. We will focus on specific programs that are critical to protecting the coast and ocean, and in the coming months, we'll likely solicit the council's approval in sending letters to state and federal leadership highlighting the value of these programs. OPC staff remains committed to continuing collaboration with our federal partners and we will look forward to opportunities to fill critical funding gaps for research, monitoring, and restoration, as well as other ways to leverage our work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I know we've had a long time since we had a non-phone meeting, so I can appreciate the amount of things that have happened since then. Are there any questions or comments from council members?
Just through the chair. As it relates to red flags on that budget, on the budget, I mean, are there issues particular concern that you've identified?
Yeah, as I mentioned, that budget is still very draft, but the proposed potential budget cuts to NOAA, to the programs that fund the National Estuarine Research Reserves, to the significant elimination of the Sea Grant program, those types of things are on our radar, in addition to the significant funding that goes to our state coastal management programs to support the coastal zone management programs.
And just out of curiosity, because we're having the same conversations, obviously, at state lands and more broadly, you know, across other agencies. But curious from perspective of the secretaries, I mean, have you guys, is there an aggregated list of that you've put together that sort of identifies the biggest areas of concern as it relates to our respective advocacy, as it relates to highlighting those concerns and then creating a strategy to help mitigate them by creating a counter-narrative? Is there anything we've put together?
Matt looks like he's...
Well, I can say that at Cal EPA, we have looked at the budget. You've always got to be careful about reacting too quickly to a budget like this, because we know that it'll change quite a bit. But we have identified the programs within Cal EPA that would be affected by the budget cut. What we're trying to do is then assess, you know, where our priorities there. But we've got to be careful that, and I would just mention that in connection with some of the programs that you identified here. I've received a number of recommendations from within Cal EPA. We should object to this or that cut.
Right.
And we need to be careful about responding to those cuts, because then it will appear that we don't care about the other cuts. So we are trying to come up with a comprehensive strategy to react to the federal budget. Just globally, our position has been that we've had a very good working relationship with the federal government over the last 8 years. We are dismayed by the cuts that are being presented, particularly to our partners at NOAA and US EPA. We think that it's critical that we look at those programs and do what we can to get funding for those programs and make sure that our partners at the federal level are well-funded. So we're trying not to pick and choose at this point which programs to focus on, but there are a couple that stand out. As I said, at Cal EPA, it's the potential for cutbacks in some of the brownfield funding. We need to make sure that we continue to get funding for our drinking water programs and clean water programs. So there are some examples, but they're examples, and as I said, we're trying to make sure that we don't dam other programs by focusing on a couple. But I think that we do need a comprehensive strategy. And we can develop that as we see more coming out of the federal government.
And from a timing perspective, all of this obviously is relevant with the May revise coming up and areas where we may want to prioritize backfill as a state and respectively as state agencies as well with discretionary funds here and there and grants. But it's, I get the point of it being a moving target, but it's, the cuts, it's rather extraordinary. I mean, with a little editorial, I mean, everybody that's actually looked at these cuts, they're just extraordinary. I mean, these are not, it's not cutting fat. I mean, this is proverbial bone, right? I mean, these are serious cuts, the likes of which we haven't experienced even during the difficult Bush years. I mean, and my fear, of course, now is they're in a position to actually deliver on these cuts. And so that's why I highlight this as a point of more concern than I typically would, because you're right, give and take of a proposal and an actual implementation of the same is obviously, one does not equal the other, but I'm concerned that they can deliver.
And I think I would add, I just subscribe to Matt's comments, but in our arena, which is broader than oceans, we have firefighting, we have federal forests where there's millions of acres of land in California, and even in the past administration, they didn't have enough money for the restoration after fires, and they were sitting here trying to figure out every year how to have enough money for fires. 10% of the Coastal Zone Management Program is a federal grant, as was mentioned, estuary. A lot of the money toward fish for both NIMS and NOAA that very much relate to California issues. So there is a whole list, and I think the one comment I'd add to Matt that sometimes we don't want to point out to them what we think we're most concerned about. I think even if they were to adopt a budget with these cuts, we're still 6 months away from the cuts. And I think that the administration is putting together a budget without reacting to the federal cuts that will be adopted on July 1st, but with an understanding, and you're listening to the environmental people. If I was still budget chair, I would be telling you about dental care for kids and children's health and those things that are at risk in a major way as well.
That's right.
Through the chair, but I would agree with the lieutenant governor. I'm in this position right now where I say, look, I've seen bad budgets before. Certainly in the 80s, I remember working with the Coastal Commission and looking at the concern we had about cuts in federal funding that would support our coastal programs. And I won't say that those were good days, but we weathered those days. And so, you know, I'm walking this fine line of saying, look, we've been through these bad budget times before, but I will say that this is far more unpredictable. I think that given the Congress right now, as well as the unpredictability in the administration, these are there's great reason to be concerned, and we all need to be very vigilant, and we'll be working to coordinate our responses to the federal government.
Appreciate it, both of you. Thank
you. Then we'll move on to the report from the science advisor, Tom.
Thank you, Secretary Laird and Jen. I think I didn't write this down, but I think it should be apparent from Jen's report that Deborah deserves a commendation for selecting Jen as her deputy and interim executive director, because she hit the ground running and is kicking ass.
And she really took a lot of value of the 2 weeks she was deputy director.
Yeah, she really did. Yeah. We'll hear more about sea level rise later, but there's an awful lot going on with regard to ocean science. I've come up with a sort of tagline that in the realm of a changing ocean, the relevance and need for an ocean science trust has never been greater, because responsive action from a policy and management perspective needs good science to guide it. And I'm going to highlight a couple things that we're working on in that regard. First and foremost, we have an upcoming science advisory team meeting on May 23rd. At that meeting, we have already initiated getting nominations for 2 vacancies on the science advisory team. And so if you know smart, thoughtful scientists that want to influence policy and management, please send them our way. We're going to do 2 principal things at the SAT meeting.
You could have recruited at all the marches this last week.
Yeah, we could have, yeah, based on the best sign. We're going to do 2 principal things I think are aligned in an agenda context. At the last April 18 meeting, we talked a lot about horizon scanning and looking ahead at what are the emerging science needs for ocean management in California. So we're going to spend the morning working on that. I would note that a similar endeavor was done before the last OPC strategic plan to identify the key science, what science is needed to inform policy and management. So it's well timed for a re-up of the OPC strategic plan. The afternoon's going to be devoted, as Jen referenced earlier, to working with the full science advisory team to sort of pencil out what is this ocean synthesis in the 4th climate assessment going to look like? What disciplines should we take on or not? How aligned can it be with the regional assessments and how they're going on? How do the sort of sponsored projects interact with the other work that's happening at the science advisory team and through the council and Ocean Science Trust to sort of synthesize that into something? We had a talk with the 2 authors of the National Southwest section of the National Climate Assessment, Skyly McAfee and Nate Mantua. They have 2 pages, or 2.5, to do their. You know, we're thinking 30 or 40 pages will help us with the full breadth of the California coast. So folks are encouraged to come to that meeting. They are public meetings, and we're going to have part of our team sort of run a same sort of brainstorming and thought exercise around this with the public members, as the SAT does their work as well. Let's see if I... and then coming out of the SAT meeting, we'll establish a science advisory team working group. We're thinking having some focus groups over the summer to kind of bore in on some of these issues, because they are, large and complex. In the same climate change arena, you know, Jen mentioned the Science Advisory Team Climate Change and Fisheries Working Group that we've been working on with the Science Advisory Team to support the department in the Marine Life Management Act Master Plan update. We see this as a really, really pivotal project in the whole master plan sphere. You know, climate is really affecting everything in the oceans. You know, I came over here from terrestrial conservation work, and I often point out that at least the air isn't getting more acidic. It's getting hotter, but it's not getting more acidic, which is a, you know, sort of a weird thing to think about. Climate change, so there are some main points in the report, and I'm going to run through some of the bones of the report. And I would note that one thing that Ocean Science Trust is doing, just to make sure this report really supports the department, is we've commissioned someone to sort of render it down into a real in-brief four-color document for you know, unless you guys all want to read a 75-page report. I think it's really important to kind of render this down into a good four-color report. So first and foremost, climate change is already impacting California fisheries. Jen mentioned HAPS. You know, harmful algal blooms are anticipated to increase in severity and pervasiveness and frequency in a warmer and more acidic ocean. So already we've seen some pretty catastrophic change happening. The effects are wide-ranging, multi-stressor, and importantly, the report really takes on the social aspects of it, that human communities are really affected by this. Fishing communities up and down the coast really get affected, and there are economic consequences. There are approaches, however, that exist to adapt, to help the department and these communities and fishermen adapt to these this exacerbated variability in the ocean. And it's important to note that California is already highly variable in the way the California current responds to decadal and annual and seasonal variations. So the department is accustomed to variation, and I'll get into some of the scenario planning that we're recommending be considered moving forward. So four possible scenarios were considered and highlighted by the working group, tied to seven possible management approaches, and I'm going to quickly go through those. First and foremost, as I just said, historic variability continues in the California current, and you just got to manage your fisheries, you know, according to that variability. Second possible scenario, the variability increases in severity and causes extreme events, and I would include the domoic acid crisis as an extreme event. Third, that there will be range shifts, fundamental range shifts in some of the fisheries that occur. Through ocean temp and circulation patterns, we could see, you know, well, as we have seen, squid moving north and other fisheries changing range. And California, by the way, you know, there's been a lot of work in the mid-Atlantic states because it's such a segmented jurisdiction north-south that they've really had to think about how to work together on those fisheries. California's got the advantage of having a long coastline and a single department, a marine region that's charged with managing it. And then fourth and most, you know, sort of ominous is where you cross a threshold to a tipping point and fisheries are fundamentally changed. And there's, you know, Ocean Conservancy is doing some work on looking at those tipping points. So what are the management possibilities? First, manage for ecological resilience. It's the same tenet wherever you go when you're responding to climate change, you try to enhance ecological resilience. And there are five recommended steps. I'm not going to run down the steps. I'm going to give the big buckets. Manage for social resilience. A fishery is defined not just by the fish, but by the human communities that rely on that fish for their livelihood. There are four recommended steps to consider in the report. Expand cross-boundary coordination. If these fisheries really start to move further north, we have to be working with colleagues in Oregon, Washington, or for those that go towards equatorial regions with Mexico. And there are three steps in that. Increase research and management capacity. You know, obviously, as I said, we need better science. The harmful algal bloom work, you know, immediately highlighted the need for a higher resolution of sampling get more predictive and affirm our models better. Increase management flexibility. The department, you know, you used to be able to just set a fisheries management plan and kind of roll with it. Well, if the variability is really increasing, you really need to start getting more flexible, or if fisheries are shifting ranges, you really have to have more management flexibility. And it's hard to blend that with predictability, right? Because these are human communities that are relying on it. And there are four steps there. And then strengthen monitoring and forecasting. Again, that's an effort to make things more predictive, create more consistency, and those are seven steps. There are seven steps to be considered in that. And we've got in brief, we've got a little sort of Zagat survey with dollar signs of what we think these steps might cost, which immediately highlights the fact that Director Bonham has been very clear and very bold in highlighting the department's structural funding deficits. And I think there's going to be a lot of hard conversation. Climate change is expensive, as it turns out, and we really need to support the department as they kind of think about this master plan amendment, and help the department through this. So that's the climate change and fisheries report. The last two notes from the science advisor: we've had a very successful rollout of the baseline information for the South Coast MPAs over the last month and a half, 2 months, thanks to Cindy Dawson, the four or five people at the Department of Fish and Wildlife for helping us get it across the finish line. There's the Fish and Game Commission is taking it up tomorrow in terms of adopting the baseline reporting on conditions. Ocean Science Trust has also signed up to work with OPC and Cindy in particular, but also the department on rolling out the North Coast baseline monitoring results. That will conclude the baseline period for the MPA program, and we start to think, and I think it's not too soon, certainly not too soon, to already be thinking about how does the work we're doing now sort of help us leverage the long-term monitoring looking forward. I think with changing ocean conditions, MPAs will continue to play a very instrumental role in ocean management moving forward and really refining what that means. I mean, I know, John, Secretary Laird, you've been talking about it for years, about the role of MPAs in ocean resilience. And really starting to resolve that from a scientific perspective, I think, is an important step. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments from members?
Thank you. I don't know if this is a question for now or later, but as part of your comment about increasing flexibility in terms of fisheries management, I assume that includes, or could you elaborate on how that includes improved data management at the department?
Well, certainly this came up at the fisheries forum as well. There are a number of steps that could be taken to increase flexibility and the saturation of data. And I'll just use HABS as an example, because the Harmful Algal Blooms Working Group of the SAT really looked into how do other regions work on this. And for the razor clam fishery in New England, the stakeholders, the people out doing the fishing, are collecting the samples in a scientifically valid way that then give you the data points to validate the predictive models and help you understand the process's depuration, how quickly these toxins will clear out. And I think that's a sort of fundamental shift for the department to sort of start to embrace this more stakeholder-driven data collection on the thing that the permittees are doing. And I know that's been a topic of conversation, and that's just one example. I think, too, that, data management is also costly. And, again, kudos to Director Bonham for kind of talking about the elephant in the room. We have to really be thoughtful about how fisheries management takes on these new data, how it incorporates ocean condition data, which is not typically considered. So there are a number of discrete steps that can be taken. And it's important to note in the climate change and fisheries report, a cynic would say, well, you're just going to say catch less fish. And that is not what the committee did. The committee really wanted to kind of come up with tractable management steps that could be taken to sort of adapt to these changing conditions rather than just a mandate of catch fewer fish.
And I think just to add to that answer, the comment he made about having stakeholder collection of data in a scientific, valid way was the key phrase in that sentence. And I think that's the hardest thing to negotiate, is trying to figure out how to do that so it is valid. But movement in that direction is significant. Other questions or comments? Matt.
Just a comment to note that I know the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment is working on their climate indicators report. The last report came out in 2013 and identified what OEHA was seeing as already indicative of climate change in California. Our estimate is that the next report should come out probably the end of the summer. I'm hoping for August, but I've heard it may be September. But I think it'll work very well in conjunction with the work that you've done. And then it's incumbent on all of us to get out and really talk about what we're finding in these reports to address that comment that we hear so often about, well, you know, is climate change real? Well, reports such as the one you've just been discussing suggest that not only is climate change real, but it's already occurring and having impacts here in California. And that's why we need to work with others to do something about it, both in terms of mitigation and adaptation. So I appreciate all the work that you've done. And, you know, we'll look forward to using it in conjunction with some of the other work that's being done in the state.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about sea level rise, and Sarah Newkirk is here. At a recent meeting, she was pointing out that the ocean acidification seems like an abstraction, but there are human communities that are really feeling the effects already, these fishing communities. And the more we can sort of relate ocean acidification, ocean change, physical chemical change to impacts to people, we're going to get more traction as we're starting to see on sea level rise.
Great. Other questions or comments? And thank you very much, Tom, for your report. We'll move to item number 4, the action items. Approval of council action from the December 7th, 2016 teleconference meeting, and our approval of a revised interest code. Jen.
Thanks, Secretary Laird. This item is to approve the December 7th meeting minutes and our revised conflict of interest code, as you just mentioned. I'd make a quick note about the meeting minutes. During your December meeting, the Ocean Protection Council authorized a grant to Ocean Science Trust to provide science services and science communications to the Ocean Protection Council. The staff recommendation in that grant included a project timeline from July 1st. Of 2017 to February 28th of 2019 to ensure the continuation of those science services once the existing funding expired in June 30th of this year. However, since that December meeting, Ocean Science Trust has received a time extension to complete the science service activities under their existing grant through September 30th of 2017, prompting the need to extend the start and end dates of the new grant by 3 months to avoid having two overlapping grants with duplicative scopes. So the approval of your December meeting minutes should reflect that the start and end dates for the timeline in the Ocean Science Trust's Science Service Grant are now October 1st, 2017 to May 31st, 2019. And leadership at Ocean Science Trust and OPC have worked closely on this issue and are completely supportive of this update.
Then before we move to the second item, why don't I entertain a motion to approve this item? Motion by the Lieutenant Governor. Second by Secretary Rodriguez. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? Carries unanimously. We'll move to approval of revised conflict of it. And I received no cards of people that wanted to speak, so I'm just clarifying that now that we've acted. Now we'll move to the next item. And if anybody has a card that they wanted to speak on the last one, I'll get it.
A review of OPC's conflict of interest code revealed that it is out of date and does not accurately reflect the physical location of OPC in Sacramento or our staff classifications. The revision corrects the changes and updates reporting categories to bring OPC in line with other councils, commissions, and boards. I just want to point out that these revisions do not eliminate the requirement of OPC's state elected officials, the Secretary of Natural Resources, the Secretary of Environmental Protection, or the Chair of the State Lands Commission to file. They will continue to file their Form 700s in their capacity as elected officials and state agency leadership rather than members of the Ocean Protection Council. Ocean Protection Council's public members will continue to file their Form 700s under OPC's Conflict of Interest Code.
Well, that's too bad. I could go from 21 to 20 filing Form 700s. Yeah. Questions or comments on this item? Is there a motion to approve? Motion by the Secretary, second by further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you for that. We'll move to item number 5. It's also an action item, consideration of authorization to disperse Proposition 84 funds for research and development. Holly Wire, the program manager, is going to present. You're probably going to have to be a little closer to the mic. Thank you.
Is this better? Yeah, all right, wonderful. Thank you, Secretary Laird. I'm the Marine Pollution Program Manager at the Ocean Protection Council. Testing, testing. Are we good? Thank you. I'm the Marine Pollution Program Manager at the Ocean Protection Council, and today I'll be presenting a proposed project that would develop trash monitoring methods for funding consideration under Proposition 84. Just to provide some brief background, Proposition 84 funds may be used for a wide range of purposes, including scientific research, adaptive management, and conservation of marine resources. This project focuses on scientific research, and the tools developed by the project may be used to inform policy decisions in the future. This project will address a high priority research need identified by our partner agency, the State Water Resources Control Board, or the Water Board. To provide some background, the Water Board adopted what is commonly known as the Trash Amendments in 2015. These amendments to the water quality control plans for both ocean and inland waters prohibit stormwater systems from discharging trash larger than 5 millimeters to waters of the state. When the trash amendments were being considered, the Ocean Protection Council sent a letter of support to the Water Board encouraging adoption of the amendments and also called out the value that our agency places on using scientific measures to track and verify effectiveness of state policy. Currently, there is not a standard scientific method to measure trash in water, so the water boards can't advise a regulated community to assess trash using an existing EPA method, like they would for another pollutant, say mercury. This project would provide up to $800,000 to the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project to field test, validate, and standardize scientific trash monitoring methods. These methods would be valuable tools to assess the changes in trash amounts and composition in receiving waters and receiving water channels, and habitats over time. This project, like many of our projects, was developed in with partners. We did develop this in partnership with the Water Board, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, and the San Francisco Estuary Institute. The San Francisco Estuary Institute will be partnering with the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project on implementing this project, should it be approved. This project would include a technical advisory committee and a stakeholder communications component to ensure that we are building on past work and taking advantage of existing expertise while ensuring that the tools that come out of this project are useful for the regional water boards, the local stormwater agencies, and the conservation community. The ultimate goal of this project is to develop a suite of methods to monitor receiving waters in for trash in a variety of habitats throughout the state and to make those methods available and accessible to stakeholders who may use them. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
I know. Well, it's just that the agenda, it's just irresistible. It says research and development of scientific trash monitoring. And I just want to be clear, it's for all trash, not just scientific trash.
It is for all trash, not scientific trash.
Great. I thought one important comment, which is we sort of loosely lumped the most important and prioritized activities we do as a council into four items, which is fisheries management, which includes the MMPA and the MPAs and other things, ocean acidification, sea level rise and resiliency, and then marine debris. And I know that, you know, we took a position on the plastic bag initiative and have done other things, but it seems to me this is one of those items that sort of helps us meet that goal, and it's just good that we are out there doing it. So I just think it's a great proposal. Other comments?
Just yes. To the chair, begs the question, haven't we been doing this? I mean, has there been, I mean, hasn't there been other efforts that sort of similarly has been assessing, or have they just been privately funded through NGOs or?
There are efforts privately funded through NGOs. There's a lot of efforts that use citizen science or use coastal cleanup data, which is great, and it gets us to a certain point. But these methods would help us move beyond that and start making more targeted assessments of the problem and what kind of, and opening up potentially new solutions for us to use.
And the 800,000 for people, for data, for IT, what's the sort of flesh out the use of the funds?
So that number was developed through speaking to some folks that had done prior in-water monitoring projects, and the 800,000 is to field test and develop approximately 4 monitoring methods. It's somewhat expensive because the methods usually need to be tested on the beginning end of a storm, and so you have this issue where you have to mobilize staff and mobilize equipment and get people out there by a certain time. And sometimes you'll do all that and then the storm will hit a few miles to the north or something. So it's a little, so it is expensive, but there it really needs to be done.
Interesting. And over the beginning, middle, and end of this, what kind of, how long is the process?
Oh, 3 years.
3-year process.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Any other questions? Yes, Tom.
Just a comment that when you go to the UN conference, there is a sustainable development goal on marine debris and marine trash. And I think some of the work in California can inform through a voluntary commitment of education or whatever the global effort on this topic, because, you know, the Lieutenant Governor raises an important point that these techniques are still being worked out. That we really need to get a handle on how effective the strategies to reduce trash really are from, again, not just scientific trash.
And it's really, I think, as he identified, it's taking some of the research and some of the actions to the next step, because we have been doing it in some form. Before I entertain a motion, we have one person that is asked to speak, Sean Bothwell from the California Coastkeeper Alliance.
Good afternoon, Council. My name is Sean Bothwell. I'm the Policy Director for the California Coastkeeper Alliance. We represent 12 California waterkeepers statewide. We worked on the trash amendments starting back in 2010, working on the adoption of them through 2015, and we're now working pretty regularly on the implementation of that policy. I personally was on the advisory group that helped draft the amendments. And I'll say that the development of those were very successful. We set a very strong water quality standard and really a goal that there'll be no trash present in California's waterways by, at the very latest, 2031. We also have a complete prohibition on pre-production plastic discharges into waterways. Two things that I think are really strong and really sets this national precedent of how you do statewide trash policy. But I really think the amendments really hinge on the trash monitoring aspect. The way the amendments are implemented, without strong monitoring, this really could turn into just a paper exercise where we're paying consultants to show that they're in compliance when really they're not. As staff explained, right now we don't have a standardized protocol for monitoring for trash. And I think more importantly, a protocol for determining whether they're in compliance with the trash amendments, which I think is really important. In 2014, I worked with the OPC to help bring along the resolution that was spoken about. Grateful for the letter that was sent to the State Water Board in support and asking for better trash monitoring and reporting. And the State Water Board responded at that hearing when they adopted the amendments and when they passed their own implementing resolution to implement the trash amendment. They noted that they would work with Ocean Protection Council on better trash monitoring guidance. So this is the next logical step, and I support the OPC for this project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then does anyone have a motion on this item?
I'll move adoption of the...
Motion by Matt, second by the Lieutenant Governor. Further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you. We're going to move to item six, an informational item, which is a presentation on sea level rise. Item seven that will come right after it will be the action item on this subject. And I'm going to ask Paige of the staff to give a brief introduction to the process and then introduce the presenter.
Thank you, Secretary Laird. Good afternoon. I'm going to provide an overview on our process to update the state sea level rise guidance document, and then I'll hand it over to Dr. Kahan, who will present on the science report, which will be a foundational piece for updating the state's policy guidance. One critical goal of OPC sea level rise program is to work at the local, regional, and statewide scale to ensure that California is prepared for and successfully adapts to the impacts of sea level rise and storms. An important component of this program is ensuring that the state sea level rise guidance document is based on the best available science. Therefore, OPC is leading a process to update the guidance document. May I have some slides? Great. The state's guidance document was initially released in 2010 and updated in 2013. It provides guidance to state agencies for incorporating sea level rise projections into planning, permitting, investments, and other decisions. Since the 2013 update, new science has emerged, which has prompted the need to update the guidance document. The updated guidance document will focus on the needs of state agencies and local governments. It will serve as a helpful resource for cities and counties as they comply with SB 379, which directs local governments to incorporate climate adaptation and resiliency into the safety element of their general plan. It will also assist state agencies prepare for and adapt to climate change as directed by Governor Brown's Executive Order B-3015. Throughout 2017, OPC staff and partners look forward to continuing to engage with state agencies, local governments, tribes, vulnerable communities, NGOs, and other constituents to update the policy guidance. At OPC's October 2016 meeting, the Council approved funding for the Ocean Science Trust to convene a working group of OPC's science advisory team to summarize the best available science on sea level rise with a particular focus on ice loss. In early 2017, the Ocean Science Trust convened this working group, which consists of seven interdisciplinary experts. In addition to Dr. Kahan, we have here today Liz Whiteman from the Ocean Science Trust, who was integral in convening this group. The working group had numerous meetings throughout 2017 and as an independent scientific body. Two members of the group, Dr. DeCanto and Dr. Fricker, provided a synthesis on ice loss science, which is included as Appendix 2 of this science report. Simultaneously, a policy advisory committee was convened by the OPC, which consists of representatives from the Natural Resources Agency, the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, and the California Energy Commission. The committee provided a set of questions to the working group to elicit information on the current estimates of sea level rise and to understand the scientific context around those estimates. These questions are included as Appendix 1 of the science report. At the same time, an engagement team led by Suzanne Moser, Research and Consulting and Climate Access, conducted interviews and 5 listening sessions to better understand the needs of those that will use the guidance document. This input will help ensure that the guidance is useful for planning and decision making. OPC and the Resources Agency have also been working closely with our state agency partners through the Coastal and Ocean Working Group of the state's Climate Action Team, as well as the State Coastal Leadership Group on Sea Level Rise, both of which include leadership from state agencies with coastal and ocean resource management responsibilities. Going forward, in May and June, there will be a series of public workshops to solicit feedback on a draft guidance framework of the guidance document. In late fall, there will be a 30-day public comment period, and input will be incorporated into a final updated guidance document, which will be brought to the Council for potential approval at our January 2018 meeting. This is a list of workshop dates and locations that are occurring across the state in May and June. Links to registration are available on our website, and there's more information on our website. I'm excited to introduce Dr. Dan Kahan to present on the Working Group Science Report. As I mentioned earlier, the report was produced as an independent scientific product that was requested by the OPC. Dr. Kahan is a climate researcher at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. He focuses on regional climate variability and change with an emphasis on climate and its impacts in California and the Western United States. He has played a key role in a series of California climate change vulnerability and adaptation assessments, such as California's fourth climate assessment, and in directing California-Nevada application program, which conducts applied research and provides information to stakeholders. Dr. Kahan is a member of the OPC Science Advisory Team Working Group that produced the scientific report, Rising Seas in California, and was a member of the National Research Council Committee, which produced the 2012 report, Sea Level Rise for the Coasts of California, Oregon, and Washington. Over to Dan now.
Secretary Laird, members, staff,
welcome.
Okay, so I'm going to run through some highlights here on this study. And I guess before I begin, I would say that this report was kind of conducted at light speed in most of our experience. And I think the fact that it got done was really attributable to the staff at OPC who really were involved at every step of the way and made this happen. So Paige already mentioned that this was a team product that involved experts from various disciplines, and it was a really worthwhile discussion that brings to light many of the issues that will continue to affect the state in its adaptation efforts surrounding this issue. So Paige had mentioned that there's been recent advances, so let's take a look at some of these. First of all, this slide makes the point that sea level is rising over the last couple of decades. It's interesting that if you look at that top dark shaded trace, which is the total global sea level, which is measured using satellite altimetry, which goes back to the early 1990s. It's important that the rate of rise here, which amounts to a little more than 8 centimeters in this little over 2-decade period, is about half of the amount of sea level rise that occurred in 100 years previously. So the rate of sea level rise as we make it now has about doubled, or perhaps a little more than doubled, from previous historical rates. And the other thing to note is that the historical rates over the 20th century, roughly, are thought to be higher than the rates that have been estimated for a much longer period of roughly 2,800 years using proxy evidence. So we are clearly on the cusp of a process that is strongly taking hold and probably accelerating. So the other thing that this slide points out is the fact that when you look at the major components of sea level rise, the red one owes to the fact that the ocean, as it warms, expands thermally. And the blue one is the other major component of sea level rise, which is essentially the added volume mass of the ocean from melting or solid ice that's imparted into the marine areas adjacent to large ice sheets. And what has happened in recent decades is this ice loss contribution to sea level rise has eclipsed the amount that previously was the dominant part, that owing to just thermal expansion. The Earth has been warming over the last century or more, and of course, with that, we're seeing these influences. So, it's widely known that the really large potential changes to ocean volume are from the stored water stocks on the big ice sheets, those being Greenland and Antarctica, and these maps indicate in the red shading where there's been mass loss on these continental ice sheets, again measured with satellite methodologies. In fact, in this case using gravitational techniques. What you notice is that Greenland is broadly losing mass, largely at least half of which is from melting, the other half of which is from calving at the boundary. And then Antarctica is much more regionalized, but there's kind of a hot spot in the western Antarctic ice sheet, which is a sort of a problem area and an area that really bears watching. Turns out that structurally, the ice sheets and the bathymetry, the bedrock makeup of these two continental stockpiles is very different. Greenland probably is more limiting in its rate of ice loss over the next several centuries. On the other hand, West Antarctica has properties that allow it to catastrophically fail and undergo sort of a runaway process. So one of the areas that became a focal point with this latest scientific discussion really was distinguishing these two sources and looking to them into their future possibilities for ocean sea level rise. So getting a little technical here, what's possibly happening in West Antarctica and in small regions around Greenland is the fact that the sea ice, which by itself, even if it melts or if it's floated out into the ocean, is not going to increase the ocean volume because it's already being felt by the ocean. But the sea ice forms what is called a buttressing reinforcement of the land ice. And as we lose that buttressing around the edge of West Antarctica and other places, that would allow the land ice to flow more freely into the ocean. And what's been elucidated by various scientific studies is the fact that this sea ice is being eroded from below, and there's also a possibility that it can also fail from fractures from above. So we kind of have a couple of mechanisms that are operating there, and it's those mechanisms which are more recently being included in the modeling studies of West Antarctica, which have kind of, I think, been revolutionary in exposing the fact that the potential for much more rapid ice loss from particularly Antarctica, is possible. It may not be strongly likely, but it does look like it's possible from this latest modeling result. Another interesting phenomena is the fact that even though we speak of global average sea level rise, when we model sea level rise and we look at the effects of the various Earth processes that actually cause the ocean to deflect in its surface, we find that there's a gravitational effect near the area that is losing mass that actually is going to cause that area to have a relative minimum in sea level rise, whereas the far field areas will have a much stronger effect than they would have been predicted to have if the entire globe was rising at the same rate. And so this map shows the so-called fingerprint of gravitational and rotational effects as ice mass is lost from the Antarctic, West Antarctic ice sheet. And what you notice is that the region of California is kind of in this hot spot of amplified sea level rise because of these effects. So the take-home number here is that we gain about 1.25 as much sea level rise as the global average. So if the global average sea level rise is 1 meter, we would gain 1.25 meters. Or if it was 10 meters, we would gain 12.5 meters of sea level rise. So this turns out to be important from our global perch. So let's take a look at the projections that emerged from the committee discussion. So here's a chart that shows on the left the National Research Council guidance, which is actually the present, is the basis for the present California sea level rise guidance. And at the time that was developed, there was a mid-range value of sea level rise for much of the California coast, which was about 3 feet. So that's that's towards the middle of that orange bar there on the left. The committee also developed a high and a low estimate, which was not assigned probabilities, but ranged upwards of 5 feet at the high end and a little more than a foot at the low end, I guess, by 2100. In the present discussion, the sea level rise projections that were developed were actually made under two different constructs. The first construct was one that was process-based, that is, we undertook to look at the individual components of sea level rise, thermal expansion, the melting of ice caps and glaciers, and the mass loss from the major ice sheets were the three major contributors. And each one of those was considered independently, and those effects were added together. They were done in a probabilistic framework using various forms of estimating distributions of likelihood of each of those components. So the two rosy colored shaded bars here are based on those probabilistic estimates. It's important to note that the probabilistic estimates are attached to individual emission scenarios. So, for example, if CARB does a really wonderful job of regulating emissions and the world listens to that.
What do you mean, if?
follow the RCP 2.6 scenario, which is the more benign-looking distribution at the left, which has an upper end of a little over 3 feet. That would be the 95th percentile. And at the lower end, perhaps a little less than a foot, which is more than the historical rate of sea level rise, but much less than some of the more exciting numbers that seem to be possible. On the other hand, the RCP 8.5 distribution, which is shown again from the 5th to the 95th percentile range by the darker rose-colored bar, is shifted higher. Its median is less than 3 feet. In fact, it's about 2.5 feet. In some sense, you might think of it as a little less than the NRC scenario. But at the very upper end, which actually is not plotted on that distribution, there's a small percentage that goes well above that upper end that's illustrated by the bar here. Okay, so that's the probabilistic scenarios, and those are laid out for actually three different emission scenarios: RCP 2.6, RCP 4.5, RCP 8.5. 2.6, 4.5, 8.5 represent the radiative imbalance at 2100 that we would expect under those scenarios. That is 2.6 watts per square meter out of the radiative balance that is more coming in than is going out, which is why the globe is warming.
But for a layperson that might not talk that way all the time, you're really saying three different scenarios based on sort of lesser greenhouse gas emissions, more and a lot more, something like that is the way to explain it, right?
Yes, you said it very well.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
for you're never supposed to talk about private consultative executive conversations, but when we were briefing the governor on this last week, he compared it to the hit parade in 1950, where you actually decide what the three biggest hits are, and that's how you explain it, and he has to translate it to that. So I'm just anticipating the follow-up briefing with him and trying to figure out how I'm going to get to the hit parade.
You have a future on Madison Avenue. Okay. So that's one methodology that was used in constructing scenarios for the disposal of the guidance discussion. The other scenario was one that was really uncharted as far as likelihood, and that was an extreme scenario. The reason being that the methodology that generated the probabilistic estimates had not really caught up to, nor maybe should it have, caught up to the most recent, very fresh Antarctic modeling results. But we felt that those needed to be acknowledged and therefore introduced this so-called H++ scenario, which is the dark-colored dot that lives at 10 feet on this particular chart, which happens to be a projection for San Francisco. And it's important to note that this is not some number that was simply pulled out of a hat. This is actually aligned with an interagency sea level rise assessment that was released in January this year by a set of a task force that spanned federal agency and private membership. So this is perfectly aligned with that high end scenario on the what you might call the federal side. So here's actually a global and a local view of sea level rise as we transition from a historical time period. That's the very left-hand side of this plot, which takes us back to 1900, I believe. I'm not looking at this, so I'm just trying to remember what this says, towards the future. And if you look at the two reddish and bluish fans, those represent these two hit parade scenarios that Secretary Laird just articulated. The red one being the high end of the chart, and the blue one being the more environmentally friendly end of the chart. If you notice, as we move out to the 2100 mark, in the relatively near term, these scenarios don't make much difference. But these fans, which you can think of as the uncertainty in our knowledge of what is rolling towards us in the bright future, becomes broader and broader as the either very high-end possibilities or perhaps more mitigated possibilities approach. The other thing that's on this chart is a solid line which represents the extreme scenario, the so-called H++, and you can see that really dwarfs, especially in the beyond mid-century, mid-21st century time frame. The other thing to note here is that if you look really carefully, and I notice that nobody's looking really carefully, but if you did, you would see that San Francisco's upper...
We have written copies in front of us. Yeah. We could be looking at that and be looking very carefully.
Secretary Laird, I've been watching you. The point there is that San Francisco achieves this 10-foot number by 2100. If you notice, the global number is a little above 8 feet, and that's because of this fingerprinting amplification that could happen here along the California coast. The report actually provides tabulated data, and of course, here, the only person in this room that has committed these to memory is David Behar, who's sitting in the back of the audience. But this would allow you, for example, in the blue highlighted row of the table, to look at various probabilistic outcomes. So, for example, if you wanted to know what is the range of probability that lives kind of in the middle of the distribution that would account for 67% of the outcomes. And what you would see there is a range from 1.6 to 3.4 feet. These are in feet, not meters, of sea level rise. And accordingly, you could look at the 1 in 20% likelihood of the high end, and so forth. These are developed for not only San Francisco, but for Crescent City, which is a different environment tectonically, so it doesn't experience as much sea level rise, or La Jolla down in the southern part of the state. These are tied to tide gauge records which allow these estimates to be made. The other thing that you could do from the tabulations provided in the scenarios is you could ask the question, how likely would it be to exceed a certain threshold? So, for example, if I have a seawall that's 3 feet above a certain level, I could ask the question, how likely is it that I would see 3 feet of sea level rise at a given point in the future? And that is laid out here.
Not counting the extreme event, which would raise it to 6 feet.
This is the mean sea level, so yes, okay. This does not include storm surge and waves and the like. So that's yet another layer of information. Good point. I mentioned this extreme sea level rise scenario, and I think I won't further elaborate other than saying that it has a stronger influence from this recent Antarctic modeling result. There's a single study that was published in spring of 2016, just about a year ago, but suffice it to say that there'll be other modeling groups that will be using their own methodologies and so forth. And I think as that information matures, then we'll probably be able to contextualize this high-end scenario to a better extent than we have. So finally, key findings. We, of course, put these right at the front of the report. And I think it's worth noting that the panel was quick to point out that the scientific sort of enterprise is rapidly working on this problem, and of course this also is tied to natural events which continue to unfold. So the point is made that that assessments should not end in 2017, that this is going to have to be periodically reviewed and revised. And so much as in just about all of these phenomena that OPC and other agencies are grappling with, this is very much a learning process. Another one is that I think this study has really put a lens on these remote but very high potential sea level rise sources in the continental ice sheets, and clearly we're going to have to pay attention to what's going on in both Greenland and particularly West Antarctica as future years unroll. And then I guess finally, it's probably preaching to the choir, but waiting for higher amounts of certainty with a process that has such enormous consequence, in which we do know that the outcomes are essentially unidirectional, is not a really an advisable policy option. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think we're going to ask some questions. We're going to hear some public comments that are requested, and then we'll move on to the next item, which is the action. And I'm going to take the liberty of going first, because one thing I wanted to do, I didn't introduce this item, but when you said it had moved at lightning speed, that was actually for purpose, because when we did the guidance or the sea level rise science in a full report in 2011, if we were to do the same thing again, it would probably come on about the last day of the administration. We would not be able to look at the guidance coming out of it. We'd probably have an interruption of our direction. And so we asked to amalgamate the existing science just the way you've done and presented today, so that we could immediately turn to guidance and not lose time on this. So we were the impetus for what was the lightning speed, and we appreciate the response that people made, because it was very good. I wanted to ask a few questions just for the sake of clarity on some of the things you said. Of course, your last slide made one of the points that I wanted to do, because there's been news coverage of this as it rolled out in the last week. You said at the beginning that this was strongly taking hold and accelerating, and I think that some press accounts dwelled on the uncertainty of what the rise might be that was contained. And so it's clear that there's certainty that there is sea level rise happening and coming. The uncertainty is just exactly what the level of it is. Is that sort of where you're going?
Yeah, I think the way some people would say it is it's not if, but when. And it's very important to note that sea level rise, because we've loaded the atmosphere with essentially a greenhouse blanket, that our essentially commitment to a changed climate is going to proceed for many decades. That sea level rise is going to be proceeding, and part of the tabular information actually goes beyond 2100, and of course the numbers get ever larger. But yes, the rates are uncertain, but the direction is increasing, and it's likely increasing at a greater rate as time goes forward.
And one of the things you mentioned is you were talking about the science of the last century and what had been presented to us in 2011 when we had the last report, is that there had been 7 inches of sea level rise in the century leading up to 2011, which proves the point that it's happening, it's just accelerating. And nothing changed with that in the work you did.
No, that's a pretty accurate number. Since 93, since we've been able to observe the ocean surface globally with satellites, the rate of sea level rise has been a little more than 3 millimeters per year, which if you projected that forward over a century would be a little more than double your 7 inches number. Before that altimetry period, we think that it was more like a millimeter and a half per year.
Okay. And then I wanted to sort of draw you out a little bit on the West Antarctica piece, because one thing that I heard in a previous briefing was, and it's interesting because if anybody was just looking at the charts, and we were paying attention, if you were looking at the Greenland and West Antarctica charts, it looks like it's a small part of West Antarctica and all of Greenland, and yet that small part of West Antarctica almost represents something that could be more catastrophic.
That's true. So if the entire Greenland ice sheet melted, we would gain 25 feet of sea level. If the entire Antarctic continent melted, we would gain 200 feet, something like that. So the amount of ice stockpiled there is enormous, number one. Number two, I probably wasn't thorough enough in saying that today your eye was actually very accurate. Greenland is losing more than is Antarctica or West Antarctica combined. So that small spot doesn't dwarf the large area of loss around the Greenland continent, essentially. But as time goes on, there's a structural geometry in Antarctica that has what are called reverse sloped beds. So as you go into the continent interior, the ice actually gets thicker because bedrock is sloping down. And it turns out that if we shed all of the marine ice that is now buttressing the land ice in the West Antarctic continent, that will allow that land ice in West Antarctica to flow into the ocean. Turns out that flow increases as you push the ice back towards the continent because it gets thicker. The thicker the ice sheet, the faster it flows. So that geometry is really critical in producing this so-called runaway effect, which once we destroy the sea ice that's holding back the land ice in West Antarctica, then we have a big, big problem globally.
And the other thing that became apparent in one of the briefings is that we in California and sort of along the Pacific coast are more threatened by what happens in Antarctica than what happens in Greenland. Is there some truth to that?
Yeah, that's because of two issues. One is that there's this more catastrophic physics that is possible, so more loss of mass from Antarctica into the global ocean. That's number one. Number two is this gravitational Earth rotation fingerprint, which amplifies the effect in the far field away from Antarctica, which puts essentially California coast in the bullseye of this magnified 1.25 factor of sea level rise. So the same thing happens from Greenland. So Greenland losing mass causes not as much sea level rise around the perimeter of Greenland and more essentially equatorward and into the southern hemisphere. But we think that Greenland will not lose as much mass, so it's not as large an effect.
Then two other things. One is that I have been grappling to the frustration of you and some of your colleagues in how to compare what the outcome was in 2011 in the study to this one. And in 2011, it was ranges. It was sort of in 2050, it would be a 14-inch sea level rise, but that's the median. If we really did well in emissions, it might be lower. If that collapsed, it might be higher. And that was a simple way to explain it.
Yes.
And what I'm gathering is this research was done at a much more comprehensive way. So you talk about the thermal rays and the melted ice rays. You talk about West Antarctica and Greenland. You talk about gravitational pull. And then you get to probabilities based on scenarios. And so it doesn't make it as easy to explain to the lay people. That's why I asked about the certainty, because that's the message that they have to get, even if they're worrying about whether it's 2 feet or 10 feet. But help me with that a little in comparing those. And
it's us damn scientists. So
there's the lead in the story.
Yeah. So this process-based part of the methodology, thermal, glaciers, ice sheets, gravitational fingerprinting, that was all done in the 2012 NRC study. But what's new is, we parsed these out by different emission scenarios, and unfortunately, we don't have a way to weight the odds of RCP 2.6, RCP 8.5. So we have sort of an irreducible dependence there.
Meaning in many ways, you can't determine yet what the different emission scenarios are going to be that trigger the different levels of sea level rise until they more assert themselves in some way.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the case, that human behavior policy technology is really a, you know, it lives behind the curtain, and it could have a big influence on those emissions trajectories. You know, if the entire world was following California's lead, then we might be shading towards the RCP 2.6 world, but right now, of course, that doesn't look like the case. So anyway, that's number one. And number two, now we have more information, which allows us to look at this in let's call it semi-probabilistic fashion. So we've taken a stab using the published results of Robert Kopp, who was on the panel, who was able to make these calculations that are essentially frequency distributions of sea level rise over the next two centuries. And so those two aspects depart from what was done in NRC 2012. And then, of course, the new evidence from both observations and modeling exercises expose the fact that Antarctica seems to be more potent in its ability to raise global sea levels than it looked to be in the 2011 era.
Leads to my last question perfectly, which is, you said during your presentation that this science needs to be updated periodically. Do you have any advice on at what intervals it would be appropriate to update this?
Well, so the international community does this nominally every 4 years with the IPCC exercises, 4 to 5 years. California conducts a statewide climate change vulnerability and adaptation assessment, which is also, it's kind of linked to the IPCC schedule. And so that's one source of valuable information here. Now, it could be that in the midst of those time periods that there may be new evidence that, you know, stands everything on its end, and it might revolutionize things. So that, you know, it, I would say 5 years nominally, and with the, you know, if something really spectacular happened as far as new evidence, then you might want to think about
accelerating that. Thank you very much. That was really helpful. Questions from other council members?
Matt? No, go ahead, please.
I guess the first question is that in my job, it frequently happens that somebody comes in and says, here's the report, here's what the science says, and I say, okay, we'll make a decision based on the science, and then 3 days later, somebody comes in and says, no, this is the really definitive report. It reaches a totally opposite conclusion. So I saw there's a discussion here on various studies on projections on sea level rise in the California coast, but how does your report and the conclusions in your report just generally on sea level rise worldwide, how does that stack up with other reports that are out there? Nobody's concluding that the sea level is lowering, right?
Well, I'm not sure I could say that definitively.
I'm sorry. I've learned to ask those questions of scientists carefully, so yeah, go ahead.
Well, let's put it this way. Recently, New Jersey, Boston, the United States, the report I mentioned that was the interagency mm-hmm. effort, 2017, mm-hmm. have assessed sea level rise for their various purposes, and the results are, I would say, reasonably consistent with the present one. Methodologies were quite similar. Boston was a little more aggressive about including the latest mm-hmm. Antarctic modeling studies, mm-hmm. and their, you know, if you looked at their distribution, it would be higher than the equivalent California if California was on the East Coast. So I would say that we are we have sister efforts that are pretty much in the same league, and the tendency, I think, as a community has been for this upper end of sea level rise prospects to have increased, actually, I would say enormously mm-hmm. over the last 5-8 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and I didn't hear it discussed all that much here, but Secretary Laird used to say that you don't want to, and he probably still says it, you don't want to just focus on sea level rise going up 3 or 4 inches. Really what you need to focus on is what that increase in sea level rise will mean during extreme events. You talk about somebody cannonballing into a bathtub.
A two-year-old, which some people at the table might be able to relate to.
Yeah, okay. So did you look at this in this report, or what should we be doing about to look at the possible impacts of these extreme events given sea level rise, the fact there's more water out there in the oceans?
Yeah, that's a great point. There is a section in the report that certainly reviews the fact that our historically our highest sea levels have, or at least the bulk of them, have happened during El Nino winters, when there's essentially Pacific Basin ocean atmosphere processes that inflate sea level along the West Coast, and they also increase the frequency of large winter cyclones. So 1983, when we saw essentially the most catastrophic storms in most of our memories here that had the most damage along the coast, was when we had a very large El Nino. We had a huge, essentially almost a Pacific Basin scale cyclone. And we had a very high tide, January 27, 1983, when many, many structures were lost along the West Coast. So that's a situation that has to be paid attention to. That's where weather forecasting as well as climate forecasting kind of comes together, as well as just kind of watching tide gauge deflections. We had a large El Nino, arguably, year before this last one. Didn't have the effects hydrologically that maybe we might have anticipated, but it did raise sea levels above tide prediction by 20 centimeters in many tide gauges for weeks. Hmm. We dodged the bullet because we did not have big storms on high spring, you know, full moon, new moon situations. But those are the settings we have to watch out for. And as we move forward, those still will be the kinds of forces that really inflict a lot of damage. It's just that the bathtub is raising, to use the example, so you're not as far from the rim when you do the cannonball. So probably get more water on the tile floor.
And just the last question. This,
well, you have to hope it's tile.
This question is actually for Paige, I think. I just wanted to know the extent to which we coordinated our work on this with other interested departments. I know that BCDC, for example, had looked at sea level rise in the past. I know the Coastal Commission has looked at it in the past. And I just want to make sure they were part of this process and that we can sort of use this report as a baseline for all engaged or all relevant boards or departments here in the state. And we'll all be operating from the sort of same set of information.
Absolutely. We are coordinating with the Coastal Commission, BCDC, and other state agencies. Both Coastal Commission and BCDC are a part of COCAT, as well as the State Coastal Leadership Group. So we have been coordinating with them and look forward to continue to coordinate closely with them.
Okay. So there are no other reports that are going on right now. This is the one we'll be, this is the most recent one, except for OEHA, and I don't know. I'll go back and check and make sure that whatever they're doing, they've looked at this. So, but as far as you know, this is the report that we should be looking at right now.
In terms of the science, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And just through the chair on that, the Coastal Commission, they sent us this memo. Is anything in here you can summarize as it relates to their concerns? I mean, they've highlighted some concerns about the extreme H++, but there's some other amendments, at least they're arguing for or advocating for. Is there any summary of what they're looking for as it relates to the spirit of that cooperation?
Yeah, I think there are staff here from the Coastal Commission that will speak at public comment, so they can address that. But I would just say I think this letter was incredibly helpful as we take the science and now pivot to drafting the updated policy guidance. I think the Coastal Commission has years of on-the-ground experience integrating sea level rise into local coastal programs and working closely with local governments. And so I think their feedback on the way that the science information was presented and the way that we can presented to be more usable and understandable in our policy guidance is really helpful. I don't have any answers about whether we're going to use 5.5 feet as a midpoint or not, but I think the feedback is very helpful and welcome, and we look forward to continued conversations not only with state agencies but local governments and constituents that are going to be affected by sea level rise.
I think to answer the question too, I read through the lines, and I think they were colloquially saying some of the local governments will think, oh, there's a range and it's really low at the low end. We don't have to do anything. Figure out a way to help us tell them that this is real and they are going to have to adapt. So I think that's part of the message from there.
I get it. Interesting.
And did you have any other questions?
No, I had the benefit of a meeting privately right before, so I'd be acting, asking questions I have answers for. But I'm curious because we were getting to it, and then we ran out of time because we had to run over here. But I know your job's not to be a policymaker, not to make recommendations as it relates to, all right, this is all interesting, but what the hell do we do about it outside of maintaining our status as an international leader as it relates to low climate, green growth strategies and radically change the way we produce and consume energy. But beyond that, are there specific issues that within the scientific community you sit there and in a casual conversation say, boy, what the folks up in Sacramento, they should really be thinking about this in the context of sea level rise, in terms of adaptation, in terms of creating flexible systems, in terms of land use planning, whatever it may be. Are there aspects of your consideration, just looking this from your layperson perspective, not your professional role?
Well, in the near term, I think this more probably trying to avoid these short period extremes, which seem recoverable, but there's certainly there's chances that 1983 could repeat in the next 20 years or next governor's administration. But as time goes on, there's some really important issues that not only affect our coastline but the Bay Delta, and you know, we have all those levied islands in the Delta, which if they're overtopped, the circulation changes, the salinity gradient possibly changes. It sort of, you know, if we have tunnels, the input, the pipes that draw the water from the tunnels are, you know, they don't, some of them don't stand more than 10 feet above the existing water levels. So the design there needs to be looked at, I think, carefully. Hmm. But I think getting back to your point, I think California really has to be a leader because this is such an important problem, both from, you know, direct impacts, but geopolitically, with, you know, a lot of populations that are in harm's way, you know, a lot of disadvantaged global populations. There's also the issue of social justice here, where, you know, like other important climate issues, some of the folks that are least able to, you know, build a seawall or whatever it is, are maybe, you know, more exposed. So I think we have to think in the long term how that's going to be dealt with. I don't know if I really have the solutions. I'm just giving you a bunch of problems, but that's why you get the big bucks.
Yeah. My tax returns are about to be released, so chance to confirm that. But question, just in one final point. I mean, the one thing that is fascinating to me that was sort of an aha moment, this gravitational rotational effect, particularly as it relates to Antarctica. Out of curiosity, is that modulated over a period of time?
Oh, it's sort of instantaneous, but of course the sea level, the mass loss changes kind of slowly, we think. You know, it's not like the whole
overnight
Antarctic continent is going to give way. So, yeah.
But those gravitational forces maintain themselves well beyond a 100-year. I mean, those are sort of permanent.
Yeah, as long as the mass is there.
But they don't change as the sea level changes. I mean, their impacts then to the gravitational and rotational aspects as sea level rises that then change that input?
It's the fact that we've, you know, right now what we have in these continents is, you know, the Earth is kind of a sphere, but there's little lumps on it, which change the gravitational attraction of the fluid that is harbored on 75% of the sphere, right? So as we change those lumps and reduce that attraction, the water seeks another, you know, it's pulled by other directions.
Right.
So that's what's going on. And then the rotational thing is that as, you know how the, in your old physics class, how you had the ice skater that had his arms out and then put his arms in, and the rate of rotation and also the axis of rotation changes, and that changes the distribution of water on the sphere. So those two things are operating. I think the gravitational mechanism is probably the more important, but the other one is not negligible.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you.
We have speakers, but I'm just going to add one thing in answer to the question. One of the statistics I use all the time with regard to the Delta is a 1 foot rise in sea level in the Western Delta changes a flood event in the Western Delta from 100 years to 10 years. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at resiliency there, it is very dramatic.
Yeah. And I think we have a number that I could count on, like one or two fingers, of the modeling studies which actually are able to look at how sea level rise is propagated from the Golden Gate up into the estuary. So, you know, if you wanna throw some research money at a problem, that one seems like it could be important.
We are very responsible. We don't throw money at anything.
Just research your talk.
Yeah. have five speakers, and then we'll move to our action item. And the first one is David Bihar from the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And on deck is Madeline Cavallari from the Coastal Commission.
Thank you, Secretary, Lieutenant Governor, Councilman, and staff. My name is David Bihar. I'm the Climate Program Director at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. I've been working on climate adaptation for about 10 years since a major conference we had in San Francisco that the Lieutenant Governor kicked off when he was mayor, brilliantly.
I remember that, yeah.
And I've also been involved in the Water Utility Climate Alliance for about 10 years, actually. We founded that organization out of that conference. We're 10 large utilities that have about 50 million drinking water customers from around the country. We've been working on climate adaptation issues since then. I was appointed co-chair of the Advisory Committee on Climate Change and Natural Resource Science by the Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, and co-chaired that for a couple of years. We're focused on how to use science and decision-making around ecosystems. And finally, I was the first chair of the Sea Level Rise Committee at the City and County of San Francisco. We developed the guidance for incorporating sea level rise into capital planning in San Francisco, one of the first things of its kind in the country that's really focused on adaptation at the ground level. We just got notified that we won the Prize for Progress by the American Society of Adaptation Professionals. It'll be conferred at the National Adaptation Forum in a couple of weeks in St. Paul. So my comments are kind of coming from the adaptation ground level, at a local level. And the first thing I want to say is to commend OPC and the Science Trust for a report that I think has done a really good job of threading the needle between all of the questions and uncertainties around the science on sea level rise in general, the new science that's been coming out, including and particularly DeCanto's research on Antarctica, and distinguishing between actionable information on the one hand and cutting-edge peer review science on the other, which is a very difficult thing to do when you're talking to decision makers, as this guidance is intended to do. I think they did a very good job. The team that you put together, Dan and Rob DeCanto and Claudia Tibaldi, Helen Fricker and their colleagues, was a top-notch group, and I commend the state for bringing that group together. The report is readable. It's short, relatively short, and it's quite clear in most instances. So I think it's an important step forward, and I think it's going to be very valuable. There's a number of areas where I have a lot of agreement with the report. To keep my comments to 3 minutes, I'll go through those very quickly. I agree the science is changing quickly, especially worst-case scenarios. I agree with the part of the report that said that we need to look at worst-case scenario planning, and I agree with what the governor said the other day. He said, if it's possible, we need to talk about it, and that's absolutely true. I agree that waiting for scientific uncertainty, for certainty to emerge is not an option for decision makers. That's not what we're in the business of doing, and we're not doing that. And finally, I agree that the West Antarctic dynamic is the key one for us to keep our attention on in California because of the effects. There's a couple of things. Was that 3 minutes?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Dang.
And I know you went to a pass no credit school, so.
I fought for that. There's no yellow. Two quick things to keep an eye on. The probabilities that are in here, there's a new philosophy of probabilism that's kind of emerging in the science field. They're not true probabilities. We need to be really clear with decision makers as to what that means and what that doesn't mean. There's a mixture of probabilities that are derived from model output on the one hand and expert elicitation on the other, and I'm concerned that decision makers are not going to understand what those things mean if they're presented as quickly as they're presented in the report. We need to be much more transparent about that. And then finally, I think we need to be much more transparent and clear about where the big number comes from, the 10-foot number. That's, and Dan will, I think, disagree with this. I think he did. That's the biggest number that I've seen in any of the reports, including in the NOAA report that Dan referenced. So we need to understand where that number came from and help people to understand how to use it. At the end of the day, we'll be taxing our constituents. We'll be increasing our rates to pay for adaptation. We'll be looking for natural infrastructure options as well. And I think both of those things require us to look very carefully at where those big numbers come from and how to use them. Thank you.
Thank you. Madeline Cavallari from the Coastal Commission, and on deck is Laura Engelman from the San Diego Regional Climate Collaborative.
Thank
you. Good afternoon, Secretary Laird and council members. My name is Madeline Cavalieri, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Coastal Commission today. Coastal Commission staff would like to thank the Ocean Protection Council for your leadership on sea level rise and for your support for local coastal program planning through grant funds. As we've heard today, the council's working group has brought forward the very latest research and analysis on sea level rise, including most importantly with regard to potential contributions from ice sheet loss. This work will provide the foundation for moving forward on sea level rise planning in California. I also wanted to thank Deputy Director Eckerle for helping us with some of our questions over the last couple of days. We appreciate that, and we look forward to collaborating with her and the rest of the OPC staff in the coming months on the updated sea level rise guidance. Currently, the Commission staff is working with over 30 of the 76 local governments in the coastal zone and numerous other stakeholders on important sea level rise planning. And we expect many to look to this new report as the most current, best available science, not only after it is incorporated into the updated state guidance, but now. While Commission staff is supportive of the information provided in the report, including the inclusion of the H++ projection, which will be especially important for planning critical infrastructure, we are concerned that the probability information, as currently presented, could have the unintended consequence of reducing or reversing the progress that is being made in planning for sea level rise. Commission staff has three recommendations for clarifying the information in future documents, and that is, those are summarized in the letter that we submitted yesterday. The first is to clarify that although the probabilities provide a useful scenario that should be considered, they do not account for the latest science on ice sheet loss and therefore underestimate the high range of sea level rise that we should be planning for. As currently presented, Commission staff believes that some stakeholders may use the tables to select sea level rise projections that are lower than what is recommended by the current state guidance. Second, to present the H++ projection separate from the probability tables to make it clear that it does not have a probability assigned to it, but that it is still an important scenario to consider. And finally, to carry forward the 5.5 foot projection of sea level rise by 2100 from the existing guidance. And you've received the letter. I wanted to thank you again for your leadership with regard to sea level rise, and we look forward to working closely with you. The lights keep confusing me, but I might just say one quick other thing.
Just don't run a red.
Which is that the Commission staff understands the difference between planning for sea level rise and designing for sea level rise. In planning for sea level rise, we want to do things like assume the risks, understand the risks that are at a certain location, and that's the importance of using those cutting-edge scenarios. That's different than saying that a building or a bridge or a highway has to be in a certain location based on those numbers.
Thank you very much. Those are helpful comments. Laura Ingerman, and on deck is Sarah Newkirk.
Hello there. Laura Ingerman. I direct the San Diego Regional Climate Collaborative. I was a former OPC staffer, so nice to see some familiar faces here still. So I wanted to come up from San Diego and talk a little bit about this really important report. Thanks to Dr. Kahn for also really sharing the science. We've been fortunate. The Climate Collaborative is actually a member-based organization, and we represent jurisdictions all across San Diego County, as well as our utility, the universities, businesses, the port, and airport. And, you know, through that, we basically represent, you know, 3 million people, most of which live on the coast in San Diego. So I just want to remind folks that I know that they're no longer San Diego representation on the OPC, but don't forget about us. We are south of LA and different from LA. A few things to mention about what's happening in San Diego.
Actually, you know, that is just really hard to forget. Just for the record.
Oh, okay. So we're a technical assistance hub, and one of the we focus on climate change capacity through public agencies. We focus on mitigation, but we also focus on adaptation. And in 2017, we were actually the only California entity to receive a regional coastal resilience grant from NOAA, so we brought in close to $700,000 to really provide this backbone of support for the various different sea level rise initiatives that were happening in our region, some which are Coastal Commission LCP grants, but it also involves SDG&E is also looking at sea level rise through a CEC grant. We also have, as you know, significant military installations also looking at sea level rise, our port and our airport. So through that process, I wanted to talk about two things that I wanted to highlight coming out of San Diego through that, and that is, you know, one, we've created this regional sea level rise working group to really make sure that we're talking cross-jurisdiction, and that also has the ability to think about translating the science, and we've been fortunate to have Dan Kahan and his research team attend our meetings and really inform and work with our local governments. And through that, we're kind of creating some models for how to communicate some of this climate science, how to think about especially the acceleration rates that, you know, we've talked about in this H++ scenario, not just being the probability, but sort of the rate of acceleration that could potentially happen around the 2050 timeline. Another thing that I wanted to bring up was that our cities and agencies are really looking at this from a regional perspective. And through the Coastal Commission grants, it's really great that we're getting these piecemeal LCP processes, but it's really important that we look at regional models as well, and we have this sort of natural landscapes that integrate with each other across jurisdictions, again, with the military and important partners. And so I really encourage you guys to look at San Diego and some of the things that we're doing there. And our website for our project is called resilientcoastlines.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sarah Newkirk and then Leah Campbell on deck.
Sorry. Thank you, Chairman Laird and members of the council staff. First, my name is Sarah Newkirk, and I direct the Nature Conservancy's California Coastal Program. Congratulations. The Rising Seas document is a fantastic science synthesis that very nicely captures the evolution of our collective understanding of the forces driving sea level rise. The team of contributing scientists and the staff really deserve our thanks. The challenge for Californians has been and will continue to be how to translate the science into decisions that protect both natural and human resources in the face of sea level rise. In other words, the evolution of the policy framework needs to keep pace with our understanding of the science framework. And I think that the proliferation of consultants supporting local sea level rise vulnerability assessments is a testament to how difficult this is and the need for strong statewide decision support. There's currently a great deal of activity and swirl around the issue of sea level rise and climate change adaptation among California state agencies, to say nothing of local agencies. In the resource agency alone, there's this effort, there's the fourth climate assessment effort, there is the Safeguarding California effort, and that's, you know, without getting into what the other agencies are busy doing. This is an opportunity for the OPC to play the role that it was created for, that is to coordinate everything that's going on and to really promote the immediate use of this of the science that's contained in the document. In our view, the most important thing that the Rising Seas document does is to present this probabilistic approach. We think that the approach gives that decision makers that solid justification and quantification that they need to support decision making in the face of uncertainty. The H++ scenario is obviously a little bit different and needs to be treated very thoughtfully in the policy document. Knowing the worst case scenario is obviously very important and useful, especially when associated with infrastructure that's either very valuable or very risk intolerant, and the policy document should just be clear about when and how it should be deployed. Natural infrastructure makes sort of a sudden and decontextualized appearance in this document and is dismissed almost as quickly under the statement that it's not appropriate for deployment in most areas of California's coast. Respectfully, we disagree, and we hope that our fourth climate assessment project on coastal natural infrastructure will provide a fuller exploration of this topic and that you may then be able to incorporate into the policy framework. One of the key findings of this report that should be brought more to the surface and to the forefront is that the difference in the projections between now and 2050 is not that great. And so we talk about decision making in the face of uncertainty, but there actually is very little uncertainty about that time frame, what's going to happen between now and then. And that's not to suggest that our actions now don't impact these longer term time frames. and the risk of creating path dependency is a very important thing to emphasize in the policy document. But importantly, we have to act now. I'm going to cite a Chinese proverb because I've never done that in public comment before, and I really want to. But the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time to do it is now. And so we need to, in all of our policy, be encouraging ourselves and local decision makers to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our last speaker is Leah Campbell.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Leah Campbell. I'm the policy analyst for California Coastkeeper Alliance, which represents 12 California waterkeepers statewide. Coastkeeper Alliance, in partnership with Heal the Bay, NRDC, Wild Coast, and Surfrider Foundation, submitted a letter prior to this meeting expressing our strong support for the update and outlining a few comments to help guide the update process. Our organizations were heavily involved in the initial development of OPC's guidance document. We believe the 2000 resolution set us up for success by encouraging interagency coordination and the use of best available science. We're pleased to see OPCs again prioritizing these concepts and that there are plans for an inclusive and robust public process. We are also encouraged to see that OPC has already initiated this thorough review of the science, as we've been discussing, and that they intend to incorporate the scientific advances and new information into the updated guidance. As the Science Advisory Team report states, the science and technology around sea level rise is rapidly changing. The policy landscape is also in flux, with all of which makes this update timely and necessary. Proposed resolution acknowledges this fact, but it also recognizes the threat and urgency of sea level rise with the confidence and certainty that we believe was missing in the 2011 resolution, but believe is critical to addressing this problem. Though we're supportive of the resolution, we just offer a few principles and concepts that we hope will guide stakeholder outreach and actual development of the updated document in the coming months. Firstly, we urge OPC, as previously discussed, to acknowledge the roles of other entities, such as the Coastal Commission, BCDC, the State Lands Commission, and local jurisdictions, and consider how existing sea level rise planning efforts by those entities can incorporate the new information and guidance. Secondly, we hope that the guidance reflects coastal resilience and access best practices. This includes prioritizing non-structural adaptation strategies and restricting the use of structural barriers, such as seawalls, that could exacerbate coastal erosion and limit public access. It also includes planning that protects and buffers critical habitats such as wetlands. And it also requires addressing new and existing vulnerable development in hazard zones. We're particularly concerned about desalination and wastewater treatment facilities that are currently proposed in inundation zones across the state. Finally, we ask that OPC consider environmental justice in disadvantaged communities, both in the updated guidance document and in the stakeholder process, by actively engaging with environmental justice experts and frontline communities. We look forward to working with OPC staff in the coming months to ensure that the updated guidance document reflects these guiding principles and those of the environmental justice community more broadly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some of the people that just spoke had requested to speak on 6 and 7 both, and at least one of them on 7 alone, and so I took them all together. So I took what I had for the next item as well. So we will move to the action item, which is the actual resolution to start the guidance process for sea level rise. And I would just make two comments leading into it and then summarize what's in the resolution. The first comment is that one of the speakers was concerned that the fourth climate assessment and safeguarding and sea level rise all be coordinated. They all just happen to be in the resources agency, and trust me, they will be coordinated. And secondly, I just want to say, because I shared some of the concerns of the speaker, which is the reason my very first question was about the certainty and not getting confused about some of the ranges, that there is certainty that this is happening. It is 7 inches in the last century. It is accelerating, as was said by the presenter. It's a question of how much, not if, and we have to plan. And I just don't want that to get lost the way some speakers had a similar concern. It is happening. And so the resolution acknowledges the state's efforts to prepare and adapt to climate change, including sea level rise. It directs the Ocean Protection Council staff to use the science report as updating the state's sea level rise guidance, and it directs staff to engage in an inclusive public engagement effort to arrive on this. And let me just ask a staff question. Is there an idea of how long this process would take and when a proposed guidance document would come back to the OPC for adoption?
Yes, there's a slide in Paige's presentation that gives an outline, but we are planning a series of public workshops in May and June that will inform a draft guidance that will be out for public comment in the fall, probably October, November, with final draft document brought to, for your approval in January at our January meeting.
Okay. And then one other thing, it was the Coastal Commission spoke and there was mention. We have funded, and the State General Fund has funded, updates to local coastal plans to include sea level rise. So this will be in time to inform that process. Is that right, too?
I'm looking at Madeline because I think some of those processes are underway, and so I'm deferring to her to answer your question more thoroughly.
That's right. Some of the processes are underway, but not finalized. And so this new information can inform them. One of the reasons why I think it's so important to carry forward the 5.5 is because a lot of the work that has gone on thus far has used that figure.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. Is there any other staff comments before we move this resolution to the council for action? And seeing none, does anybody else have any questions or comments or is motivated to make a motion?
Well, we do have, we had a suggestion from the commission to change the tables. What are we, and you acknowledge that comment. I wasn't quite too sure what we were going to do.
Yeah, and so the science report, we are viewing that as an independent scientific analysis, and that's not something that we will be revising. What we are committed to doing is taking the information presented in that report and turning it into something that is addressing the points that the Coastal Commission have raised to make it more clear about what the projections do and don't cover and how to interpret the extreme scenario.
And then the point at which we'll deal with this 5.5 sea level rise issue will be as we're going through this next process. Is that the way to look at this?
Yeah, that's right. We have a lot of work to do to try to figure out how to turn this emerging science into usable policy.
Which is what I was just going to say. Is this process is to turn science into public policy. And Dan left, unfortunately. I wanted to be able to thank him for his presentation, but you could tell how he was very happy we were turning it into public policy and not necessarily him.
Can I say one final thing? I already mentioned this, but I just do want to give one final thank you to Ocean Science Trust and Liz for their incredible work in this very tight timeline.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Motion?
Second.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you for everyone that commented, worked on the study, gave us feedback, even though we have a big task to come. Then we're to our last informational item on MPAs and ocean acidification. And I just asked if you guys could be relatively succinct because we have managed to eat away at a lot of the time for the meeting.
Okay, good afternoon, council members. I'm happy to be here today to give you a very brief update on a project that you recently approved to support the MPA Collaborative Network. You can get the slides up, please. So beginning in 2012, a network of 14 collaboratives associated with coastal counties and the Channel Islands was formed to aggregate local experts and community members to help inform and support MPA management. This collaborative network was actually built on the model of the Orange County Marine Protected Area Council that was started way back in 1999 to support MPA implementation. So the director of the network, Calla Allison, has been hard at work with funding for Resource Legacy Foundation, building this network. In October 17th meeting, you approved $299,633 to support the collaborative network. It was specifically to address two specific tasks that had been identified by the MPA statewide leadership team and the collaborative network itself as being gaps that needed to get filled. The first one was to create a shared statement and vision for the partnership between the state and the collaborative network. And then the second task was to actually fund a small grants program that was modeled after a grants program that was successfully rolled out this past year and funded by Resource Legacy Fund Foundation. If you look on the slide there, you can actually see some of the projects that the collaboratives had contributed to MPA management. There was a project, several of the collaboratives did video projects. You can see David Shearer there with some locals from the North Coast. So they had some videos with kids, tribal members, and scientists talking about what MPAs mean to them. We also have collaboratives involved in the MPA Watch Program, which is a citizen science project. A lot of work, some of that led by the Ocean Science Trust to standardize the scientific protocols around that and ensure they have high quality science being collected on human use in the MPA. So the collaboratives have been integral in that. They've also been very integral in informing the locations and the content of the MPA signs that we put in up and down the state. That you can see when you go out and visit your local MPAs. So I'm really happy to report that even though this was just approved in October, we've made significant progress to date. We actually held, and Secretary Laird was able to actually attend the second day on March 26, a collaborative workshop that brought together the co-chairs of all 14 collaboratives, members from the statewide leadership team, representatives from the Coastal Commission, Department of Fish and Wildlife, to come together and create a shared statement to describe the partnership and formalize the partnership. The statement that we were able to craft that's currently under review talks about how the partnership is seeking to manage California's MPA network in accordance with the Marine Life Protection Act by integrating diverse local and statewide perspectives. That language has been put together in a memorandum of understanding that is currently under review at the collaborative level as well as the statewide leadership level. We're on track to have signatures by the end of the summer. And this MOU is really going to formalize our partnership, allow it to continue to grow, and also allow the collaboratives also to have the state recognize the collaborative's significant contribution to the MPA management program. And the second part is a small grants program. I'm very happy to announce that our grantee, Coastal Quest, was able to find matching funds for the grant program that you funded. So an additional $70,000 is going to be available to the collaboratives for their projects moving into the next year. So I'm really excited to give you this brief update. This partnership between the collaborative network and the state, the MPA statewide leadership team has been incredibly instrumental in supporting the MPA management program, and these steps that we've taken will continue to allow that to grow in the future. With that, I can go ahead and take any questions you might have.
I think that was great, and we have one speaker who would like to comment, and that's Dr. Ricky Erickson Dunsmore.
Good afternoon, Secretary Laird and Ocean Protection Council members. I'm Dr. Ricky Erickson, formerly Dunsmore, and not to confuse you all, director of the California Marine Protected Areas Program for the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. First off, we were a recipient of a grant from Ocean Protection Council to produce interpretive and regulatory signage, and just wanted to give you a brief update on that, which making great progress. And actually going to be producing more than 150 interpretive and regulatory signs, which is more than the original grant requirements. And that's in collaboration with great partners across the state, some really strategic harbors, tribes, state parks, National Park Service locations that we were unable to reach in previous work that we've done, and also some strategic private property developments like Pebble Beach and Terranea down in the Palo Verde area. So great progress there. Secondly, really briefly, we wanted to thank the Ocean Protection Council leadership, Jen Eckerly and Cindy Dawson and their team, in recognizing the support and importance of partnerships. We were one of the participants in the Marine Protected Area Collaborative Charter Workshop, and it was an impassioned, invigorated, great group of people who are really excited to put their efforts locally to work in support of this network. And furthermore, we applaud your efforts for allocating funding to support the small grants program, and we think that a lot of great projects will come out in support of education and outreach, compliance, and citizen science. And as the foundation, we look forward to supporting the efforts of the MPA collaboratives as they mature and are sustainable in the future. With that, thank you.
Thank you very much. And let me just thank Cindy for the report. And nobody should interpret the brevity of the time we had available to our seriousness of commitment on this, because we've made great progress on the collaboratives. And I'm very grateful for everybody across the state that's participating. We'll move to ocean acidification and hypoxia. Jen.
Good afternoon, council members. I'll try to keep this brief as well. So I just wanted to provide an update on ocean acidification and specifically some timely information around our international work on ocean acidification. So just a really quick background, and many of you know this, but last April we rolled out our science panel, the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. After that release, the community worked broadly to share the panel's findings and discuss how the panel outlines actions we can take right away on ocean acidification. Then in September, these partnerships really helped to pass two bills relating to ocean acidification in our legislature. In October, at our council meeting, you all approved $3 million of funding for ocean acidification work. And now we're at the stage of executing those projects, implementing the legislation, and continuing to advance our partnerships. By the end of this year, and this is what I'm going to talk about briefly today, but through our involvement in the International Ocean Acidification Alliance, we hope to release a California Action Plan on ocean acidification and have even stronger subnational agreements. So I'll skip over this, but just to say that the two pieces of legislation were authored by Assemblymember Williams and Senator Monning. And then just to note here that our previous investments on ocean acidification at OPC have been about $1.3 million, and we more than doubled that at the October meeting, just really showing our commitment to this work and that we do want to be responsive immediately. So now moving on beyond California, the Pacific Coast Collaborative brings together our West Coast leaders to address climate and energy challenges. And they identified ocean acidification as an urgent ocean health issue, paving the way for greater regional, cross-border, and national efforts. So our focus of the PCC has been an enhanced partnership with the federal government to develop and enhance monitoring across the West Coast, and that is detailed in the executive director's report. The other focus is around elevating ocean acidification as an economic and an environmental challenge. And because of that, we announced the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification. So as Secretary Laird mentioned, it brings together jurisdictions across the globe. It brings together countries, cities, states, and provinces, as well as affiliated members, so universities, NGOs, businesses, and so on. We currently have 38 members, and 5 to 10 are close to joining, including New Zealand and Queensland. So it was first announced at the Our Ocean Conference in September in D.C., it was then formally announced by Secretary Laird and Governor Brown at Western Governors Association. And the goals of the alliance are spelled out in the alliance's call to action, and it's what members endorse when they join the alliance. But At a high level, it's to advance our scientific understanding, take meaningful actions to reduce causes of ocean acidification, protect our environment, so build resiliency, and expand public awareness, and then continue to build sustained support for ocean acidification. So our work plan for the Alliance for 2017 is to continue to build our coalition, focusing on recruitment, to advance action plans that outline what members are going to do on ocean acidification in their region and how they will address the Alliance goals. And to do this, the West Coast founding members through the PCC have really been providing tools and resources to support members in building these action plans. And the last goal we have is to engage members at meetings throughout the year. So the first one being the UN conference in June, then followed by the next Our Ocean conference, and then COP23. And we're really calling on this coalition to help us continue to make headway at the international stage of recognizing the oceans in the global climate conversation. So I'll go through this quickly, but the pathway is first thinking about what I said before is really leaning on the resources and the tools that the West Coast founding members have put together in thinking about what your government can do. And then at a timeline appropriate for the given government or entity, beginning to outline actions and vetting that publicly and widely. And then throughout this and that process, we're asking for members to provide a letter of commitment by August 2017 so we can show kind of our commitment as an entity and a subnational agreement in continuing to move the ball forward. And all of this eventually would culminate in a detailed action plan at, again, a timing and scope that's appropriate for the given member. So the next steps for California are to announce, make our voluntary commitment at the UN Ocean Conference in New York in June. Our goals we're looking at right now for that commitment are modest and very attainable, but we're hoping that we can continue to keep surpassing the targets we're setting with the International Alliance. In August, we'll be releasing the California's letter of commitment to the Alliance, and then later this year, hoping to roll out the California Action Plan on Ocean Acidification. So this is pretty early in the process for all of the Alliance members, but we as a founding member feel like we want to put ours out there first or early on and be a model and resource for other regions. And then throughout all of that, we want to definitely continue thinking about our scientifically grounded funding and coordination across the California government with our West Coast partners and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. And item 9, the last item is public comment on non-agenda items, and we have two. The first one is Jennifer Lucchese from the State Lands Commission, and then on deck is Sean Bothwell.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. I wanted to provide the Ocean Protection Council with a brief update on some recent activities involving Platform Holly and some other state oil and gas leases involving Benico offshore of City of Goleta. On April 17th, the State Lands Commission received quitclaim documents from the from Benico, meaning that they have given back their rights to produce state minerals, oil and gas, offshore Goleta, back to the state. What's important about that is under California law, the quitclaim documents are effective upon receipt by the State Lands Commission. There is nothing more the State Lands Commission can do. And what that further means is that effectively over 7,600 acres of offshore property goes into the coastal sanctuary and can no longer be leased for commercial oil and gas production based on the Coastal Sanctuary Act. That same day, I'll just provide you a little context of what's happening. In the middle of your screen, you can see Platform Holly that is connected to an onshore facility by a pipeline, which is then transports the oil produced up coast through Line 96, which is owned by Venico. It then ties into Line 901, which is the pipeline that was subject to the Refugio oil spill that ruptured. That is an important aspect of this whole context because Venico has not been able to produce from Platform Holly since 2015 because of the ruptured pipeline. The same day the State Lands Commission received the quitclaim deeds, Venico also filed for bankruptcy, and that was they are pursuing a complete liquidation of their company. So what that means is in about 6 months or less, Venico will cease to exist as a company. So what does that mean for the infrastructure that's left on state land, including the Platform Holly and the two oil pier leases offshore Elwood Beach? We like to use the analogy that this is similar to the State Lands Commission being the landlord and owner of a home, and the tenant has skipped town and left all of their furniture. it's really up to the state now to dispose of that furniture and get rid of it appropriately. As I mentioned, the quitclaim documents, they're effective upon receipt. So Venico literally could have just dropped the keys in our lap and walked away. Thankfully, they did give us a little bit of time to let us know, 2.5 weeks. May I continue?
Please, okay, please continue.
About 2.5 weeks where we could work out a deal with Venico to keep their staff on the platforms because that is a facility that needs to be staffed 24/7. We entered into a temporary services agreement with them to keep them on the platform and to secure it and start the plugging and abandonment procedures through June 30th. That will enable us to go out to bid to find a third-party decommissioning trustee or contractor to come on board and basically be our project manager for the decommissioning activities. And most importantly, plugging and abandoning the 32 offshore wells. The ultimate disposition of these facilities will obviously be at the discretion of the commission way into the future after we conduct an environmental impact report. Again, our first priority is to ensure the safety of these facilities and start the plugging and abandonment procedures. The timing is highly dependent on funding as well as the CEQA process, and of course, as we get into the decommissioning and disposal of the platform, the availability of the equipment that will be needed to do that. Speaking of funding, that is the big elephant in the room on how the State Lands Commission and the state are going to address this. We have three options that we are simultaneously pursuing at this moment. One is, as required by the lease, the Venico was required to maintain a bond. We are currently calling on that bond. We will also be submitting claims against Venico in the bankruptcy proceeding. While they did quitclaim their interests back to the state, their lease obligation to restore the lease premises have not been relieved. So we will be submitting claims against Venico in the bankruptcy proceeding. And finally, Venico acquired these lease assets from ExxonMobil back in 1997. So we will also be looking to ExxonMobil for any residual liability that they have with regards to the decommissioning of these facilities. I just want to end with two notes or two additional comments. Why did this happen? That's a common question. Why was this so sudden? And why did, why all of a sudden is Venico skipping town on this? A couple of things. They were highly leveraged. We knew that they had been over the course of many, many years acquiring a lot of debt. But what really tipped the scale was the Refugio spill and the ruptured pipeline. In our estimates, the Platform Holly leases accounted for approximately 60% of Venico's assets and their income. And so when Platform Holly shut in due to the pipeline, they were unable to continue to produce and make money from their primary asset. With the uncertainty of when that pipeline is going to be fixed and up and running again, along with other uncertainties around the onshore facilities that are dependent, that Venico is dependent on, it just became too much for them and they needed to file bankruptcy. And finally, just to end, this is obviously a significant development for the Santa Barbara Channel and the marine environment for obvious reasons. This is the end of commercial oil and gas development in the in-state waters in the Santa Barbara Channel at this location. This is the last state platform in the Santa Barbara Channel. But there's also some other consequences associated with this. We anticipate seeing additional natural seep activity because of the loss of production and the repressurization of the field. We are also anticipating seeing some economic impacts coming from this development, including the loss of tax revenue to the county, as well as the loss of jobs and the fiscal impact to the state. So, in sum, this is, again, a significant situation that definitely has some benefits associated with the marine environment in the Santa Barbara Channel, but also has some complex challenges ahead for the state to deal with. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
One comment, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
Bruce Williamson, on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor. I just wanted to build on Jennifer's point about the number one priority of the State Lands Commission, which is the safety of the operations. And this is paramount to the Lieutenant Governor and the staff and the commissioners. The commission, when it met last week, actually reviewed and discussed the commission's oil infrastructure safety standards, the regulatory regime in place. And the conclusion was that it was among the most aggressive you'll find anywhere, which is obviously very relevant, I think, to the number one priority that the Lieutenant Governor and the Commission and staff are pursuing here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I actually think if we were to ask some of the questions we might have or explore this, it would take a very long amount of time. However, I just appreciate you bringing it to our attention, giving us the top-level summary, and we will expect that there will be further discussions as this moves forward because it will impact so many different agencies or issues that we are involved with.
Of course.
Let me just say, thank you for the report and having represented the State Lands Commission and Coastal Commission for many, many years. I can just imagine what the last couple of weeks have been like. So I wish you well, and we'll look forward to future reports.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if the Deputy Attorney General's signature at the time or on any of these leases, please bring it to our attention.
I will say that thought flashed through my mind.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you waiting through the whole meeting for this. Then our last speaker is Sean Bothwell.
Good afternoon, committee. Again, my name is Sean Bothwell, Policy Director for California Coastkeeper Alliance. I was planning on providing an update on the once-through cooling mitigation fee, but Director Eckerle did a great job going through all the details of that, so I'm going to try not to repeat things she said on that update. Our organization has been working on reducing marine life mortality from seawater intakes for over a decade now, which includes the development adoption of the once-through cooling policy, and now we've been focused on the implementation of that policy, both making sure that the facilities meet their compliance schedules, but also ensuring that they pay for their ongoing impacts through once-through cooling. Last year, we were very pleased to see that the Ocean Protection Council signed the MOU agreeing to take the $5.4 million from the State Water Board for ongoing mitigation fees. As Ms. Eckerle explained, 8 out of 10 of the facilities have proposed to use the standard mitigation fee, which is excellent. It'll make sure that it's a streamlined process to get those fees invoiced and sent to the Ocean Protection Council to start protecting marine protected areas. But we do have an issue with some concerns with the site-specific ones, and specifically Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon, has a very long compliance schedule, and they also take in more seawater than probably all the other facilities combined. And they have requested a site-specific determination. We have asked that there just be an independent, publicly made review and analysis of that consideration. And we would strongly recommend that the OPC and the Ocean Science Trust use their scientific expertise to review the proposal as well and provide any recommendations you might have to the State Water Board. As Ms. Secretary noted, the end of May, we expect the calculations to be finalized and invoices to be sent out, which means funding for the mitigation fee should start around summer to fall. And from our understanding, OPC plans to start working on their decision-making framework for deciding where the funding will be used this summer, and we would just encourage that that process begin sooner rather than later, and hopefully there can be an update at the August 2017 OPC meeting so that we can know kind of what the thoughts are and where the funding would go. I should note that California state agencies, there are agencies with best practices and guidance that you can look to. Department of Fish and Wildlife have a new regional conservation investment strategies program. It's a mouthful, but it's an eco-regional concept that can probably be used in this concept as well. And then once that framework's developed, we just encourage you to have a really robust public process to ensure that the funding goes to be in compliance with the one-stop cooling policy and also make sure it covers MPA priorities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That completes our agenda. The next meeting is noted at the end of the agenda, the next meeting time. We thank everybody, especially those that you saw it all the way through, and we will stand adjourned.
Thank you for sitting in after. An
honor.
I have a reputation for running a freight train, and we got off on a little sidecar here for a while. I think the sea level rise was good.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, no.
Well, to be honest, it's like the briefing with the governor just was not very satisfying. And he walked away saying, he said to me at the L.A. Park dedication a day later, he says, they don't really know, do they?
Yeah. Well, he'll always say that, things like that. Yeah. He cited some of the effects, though, when he spoke of the napkin.
Yes, because I heard it on KCBS
last week. So, you know, it resonated. You can just never.
You know, he said a scientist from San Diego told me.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, he was paying attention.
Yeah, no, he was. You can just never be absolutely sure what's sticking.
Well, the thing that happened is just before the briefing started, I'm talking to the two scientists who are sitting there waiting, and the scientist from San Diego says, you know, I really hate having to use feet and inches. I really love millimeters. That's what I have here. And I'm like, you got it. We're a feet and inches state. You got to have feet and inches.
Yeah.
It was you sound like you come from millimeters.
Britain is sort of halfway to nowhere.
Well, that's
decided.
True on Brexit. But it's like,
yeah. No, it's true. It doesn't want to be European, doesn't want to be empirically.
And
outside.
What part are you from?
Wales.
Oh, you are. Close. You have your own prince. I'm sure that's really popular.
It was imposed, yeah.
Yeah.
As many things are.
I'm old enough to remember it. His investiture when bombs went off in the distance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My legislative deputy of the last few months is from London, and she just went over for some wedding for I don't know. She was here on Wednesday and she was back on Monday or Tuesday. I just don't know how she did it. That would have made me crazy.
I remember being on a panel at a UN climate conference, and the panelists were from Catalonia, Quebec, California, and Wales. So what do we have in common? Let's all secede.
Oh, that's good.
Up the rebels.
Yeah.
Well, my niece has fallen in love with a guy from London, so I have a feeling. I'm kind of hoping they